work.
Yeah, we're gonna be here for a while, so.
The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. We have a long agenda, so we like to get out of here at a reasonable time.
Will it be today, Madam Chair?
It will be maybe. Sometime today.
Do
be
we have
sometime
a quorum
today.
Yet? Legislative days go.
Legislative days, 7 a.m.
Senator, we will come back to Senate File 1061. Senator Marty's bill. Who's presenting that?
Hi, Marty Bell.
Okay, Senator Anderson is not here yet. Senator Berglund. Well, we might not be able to go unless we have. Senator Rosen's not here. Senator Olson.
Oh, someone, I think my witnesses just left.
Senator Limmer.
Do we have quorum? I'm ready.
We have quorum.
Seize the opportunity. 8:41.
What does it do? Is it a good bill? Is it a good bill or is it a bad
bill? Got it?
Caught you by surprise.
It's right,
It's right after the Bonoff bill.
It's a single page floating there. I said this one.
There it is.
Here, let's grab it. You want to do it.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Limmer.
Sit right there and keep your seat warm.
Yes,
committee
ma'am.
Is in recess for 10 minutes.
Whoops. You should have moved faster. Okay. She should have tossed the gavel to you.
It sounds like an emergency.
Well, they needed her for the vote and transportation, I think so.
Okay.
So
let me read you out of this book. Politicians say the dumbest things.
On sale of mortgage information in the first congressman. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 241 not only examines, but it prohibits the sharing of information upon a time when a consumer would apply for a credit report at the time of a mortgage application. What happens commonly in the mortgage application process, a buyer seeks out a loan, seeks out the customer they want to deal with, or the provider of a mortgage, and the mortgage company will ask that consumer to apply for a credit report so they can conduct a background check to see if that person is financially worthy of a loan. Unknown to the consumer, the credit company, not the mortgage company, but the credit company, upon the triggering of a new credit report will share that information with a number of people they have on a subscription contract. Other mortgage companies want to know who's applying for a mortgage loan at the time of application. Credit report company uniquely is in a unique position where they know when a credit application is sought, a credit inquiry is sought, and that triggers the sharing of information about individual private citizens with a great number of competitors in the mortgage business. Senate File 241 would prohibit the sharing of this information, whether it's selling or exchanging this information, regarding the existence of such a credit inquiry. This prohibition would not apply to any other information.
No.
Such as sharing it with a mortgage originator, perhaps the service contract that might be done with other third parties that you need to have, small mortgage companies, hire...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Sarah Foley.
I don't have a copy of the bill. All I've got is an explanation of
it. I found it in my packet. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, it says S0241-1. It's a one-page document. It should be in your packet.
You can go ahead, but I still have the phone. I do have that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Lumber, please proceed. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and back up a little bit. There is this particular subdivision does not apply to the service contractors that are contracted with a loan originator. Small companies will hire service providers, processors on a loan. The secondary market gets involved when they're going to buy a finished loan from someone, from a mortgage company. That would still be allowed to transfer that for the specific performance of handling and managing that particular loan after the sale. But this prohibition focuses on the pre-application, meaning when a person applies for a loan, it triggers a credit report inquiry, and credit reporting agencies are selling that information unbeknownst to the consumer, making them an available target for a great number of mortgage providers. I'm sure they're sold to other entities too, but it's mostly focused on other mortgage providers that want to jump into the act at the last second in order to offer what might appear to be a compelling alternative offer. They aren't always that virtuous. Do you have any questions?
Are there any questions of the author? And is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 241? Senator Loomer, I do have one question. I just checked with counsel. It has an effective date, and I'm not quite sure why we would need an effective date, since if it's not there, it would be effective August 1 of 2007. But and counsel can't figure out any reason why we would have to have a separate effective date on this one either. So,
Mr. Chair, just for me to understand, would it go into effect immediately then?
No. The general rule is that unless an other effective date is otherwise specified, it goes into effect August 1st following the legislative session. So it would be the same date.
Mr. Chair, that wasn't – I think that was just put in by the revisor's office. It was nothing specific.
I think they're doing that with a lot of omnibus bill sections and so forth, so it seems to be popping up in some places where it probably doesn't need to be. So Senator Limmer moves to delete page 1, line 18, the effective date, since it doesn't add anything. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Again, is there anybody else who wants to be heard on Senate File 241? If not, this doesn't have to go anywhere else. Okay. Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 241, as amended, be recommended to pass. That means it goes to the floor. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Anderson, which bill are you filling in on?
Mr. Chair, I'm here on Senator Marty's bill. Senate File, I'm presented on his behalf, 439.
Senate File 439. This is the publicly funded health care program enrollees employer disclosure requirements. Senator Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back at the Judiciary Committee, my first visit of the year. I'm presenting this bill on behalf of Senator Marty, who's undergoing surgery, and this bill will look familiar to many of you because the Senate has passed it at least once before, and we're hoping this is the year when it can actually go all the way and become law. The bill will allow the state of Minnesota to determine which corporations or employers are utilizing taxpayer-funded health care programs in order to cover the health care needs of their employees. We know that in the United States, our healthcare system is essentially based on your employer, and traditionally, employers have been the way that most people accessed health insurance. That number or that percentage is shrinking, and fewer employers are providing health care or, in many cases, shifting the costs more and more to the employees. And in many cases, more and more of those employees are being forced to go into public programs to pay for their health care. So the premise of this bill is that taxpayers have a right to know where their tax dollars are being spent and to find out if we know if there are companies that are really piggybacking on public programs. We need to know that just to understand where the money is going and for whose benefit. So what the bill would do is allow the state to compile data on companies, not on individuals. And I understand that this committee is looking primarily at the data privacy aspect of this bill. So I'll focus on that. The threshold would be where there's 50 or more workers accessing a state-funded program. So the way it would work is if any individual in Minnesota applies for a state health care program like Minnesota Care Medical Assistance, they would, in their application, they would list who their employer is, if they're employed. And then that information would be forwarded back to the legislature in a report that would identify those employers that employ more 50 or more employees that are enrolled in publicly funded health care programs like Minnesota Care or Medical Assistance. So essentially what we would have is information, aggregate information about the numbers of people and which companies have large numbers of their workers who are using public health care programs. And we wouldn't use individual names or any other data. It would simply just be an aggregate number of the people who are employed by those companies would be reported by the health department, I presume, back to the legislature in the annual report. Sorry, I haven't.
That's fine. Yeah.
Health and Human Services.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, that's the sum of the bill. And I have with me Bernie Hess from United Food and Commercial Workers, and he's worked for many years on promoting this issue as a way to get more transparency in our health care system and our public programs. Would you like to say anything?
Sure. And, in fact, before we do, Senator Anderson, again, for the committee's benefit, the reason why it is here is because of the data issues. I'm particularly looking on page 2, lines 2 and 3, which is requiring the commissioner to take reasonable precautions to protect the identity of the health care enrollees. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's what it says. It does on 2.5 and 2.6. The report shall only include individually identifiable summary data. And then if you look further down, 2.9 to 2.13, they have to comply with the federal HIPAA laws as well as the Minnesota Data Practices Law. So, Mr. Hess, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 789 committee. I'll be real brief. We just want to find out who is using MinCare. We know that the number of employers offering health care and employees taking has shrunk. We just want to have some information so we can rationally discuss what is going on with the health care system in Minnesota. We think this is a good bill for taxpayers and for accountability. We support it. We'd ask your support on this bill also. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Are there any questions of this witness? Senator Lumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, I know on page 2, line 12, there's a reference to section 144.355. And if memory serves me correctly, that's to do with Minnesota medical or health-related data that the state has special provisions for. But I'm wondering if maybe counsel could tell me what that is again, just so I know what we're applying this law to.
Sure. Ms. Pontius, the question was on page 2, line 12, the reference to section 144.355.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lerner, that's our medical records statute that applies to, like, all the private sector some of the public sector, too, but that's the basic medical privacy statute in Minnesota law.
And, Mr. Chair, I remember, and some of us that follow data privacy, we're rather proud of 144.355 because it's a little more protective, protecting the data of medical and health records in the state more so than the federal HIPAA law. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that that's in it and that the word is and rather than or. So I'm try to check on that every time that it comes up. Are there any other exceptions to 144 or exceptions to Chapter 13, another area of our data privacy statutes? Are there any exceptions to our data privacy laws in this particular bill? Are they all included?
I don't see anything. Ms. Pontius, there's nothing.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Linder, I think everything's covered here pretty
okay.
In the references.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Linder, I mean, you make very good points. We want to be very clear, we're not interested in getting any individual personal information. That's not the purpose of this, and that shouldn't be a consequence of it. So it's we wanted the strongest possible protections of privacy.
Mr. Oliver.
I know that the title, Section 1, Employer Disclosure for Minnesota Healthcare Programs, wouldn't there be another source of information for people who are enrolled, especially these are medical assistants and general assistants? Aren't these names recorded somewhere else? And why would we go to an employer to get them when the state government may have them already?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the simplest way to do it, I think, is the way it's set up here, where when you apply for the program,
okay.
When an individual applies for the program, they identify their employer. And so,
Sarah Anderson, I think the problem is the head note is misleading because the employers aren't disclosing anything. It's the department that would be disclosing it. So I think we probably just need to maybe suggest deleting the word employer so it would be more descriptive of what it's doing. Because we're disclosing the program information, but not by the employer. Senator Limmer, would you suggest that we remove then on the head note, page 1, line 5, the word employer? Because you're right, it's confusing. It does not really describe what the rest of the bill does.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the word employer could lead maybe a future legislator to think that we do this type of thing by requesting it from an employer, and it really isn't.
Yeah, the data relates to employers.
I don't know if you'd call it agency disclosure, or I don't know what you'd call it.
But.
Okay, Ms. Pontius, do you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps if you just said Minnesota Healthcare Programs Report.
Minnesota Healthcare Programs Report.
We could say Employer Report. It doesn't make that much difference. It's just the heading. But it's nice to have statutes where people can find things based on.
They can read the head note and get an idea of what the rest of the section is. Well, this is not codified, so it isn't like anybody's going to find any of this stuff later on. But Sarah Limmer, did you have a suggestion then? Or
I don't have a suggestion.
How about Minnesota Healthcare Report? Okay? Does somebody want to move that?
I'll move it.
Senator Limmer moves that the head note, starting on page 1, line 5, be deleted and that it be read Minnesota Healthcare Report. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Is there anybody who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 439 as amended? Anybody else here? Any further questions of the witnesses?
Mr. Chair, I just want to apologize because I was looking at the original version of the bill and
sure.
Not the engrossment, so
yeah.
I apologize for
the
error.
You're picking up somebody else's bill, so that's understandable.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Where does it need to go? Does it go?
It's already been to health.
It might have to go to finance. Apparently, the report, the commission has got to prepare a report, so that might have a fiscal implication here. So Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 439 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much,
for
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Marty.
Committee members.
I just saw Senator Rosen. Is there anybody else? Any other authors here?
Where'd she go? She's in
one. Oh, okay. Any other authors that are present? Let's see. We're going to
just here.
Steven. Senator Olson, are you ready? We can go get Senator Rosen and.
Rosen just was out.
Senator Rosen's just outside the door.
Outside the door. Okay. Well, Since she's not on the committee.
Senator Siebman's here.
So Senator Olson will obviously use you to fill time. Senator Siebman, you're here. So this is, let's see, Senate File 1074, is that correct? That
yes.
is the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. Senator Siebman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I have an author's amendment that I would like to offer that clarifies some of the some concerns of the language related to the data practices.
Sure. This would not be an author's amendment because this is apparently not committee that is going to.
If someone could please offer it.
So you've already had your opportunity at the first stop, but we will have the amendment distributed. We do have. Is it really data issued? Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's apparently it's the whole bill that we really have to consider here. Yeah, there's a number of privacy issues through the bill. So, Senator Siebman, perhaps you could tell us what the bill does, and then we can look at the amendment in the context of the bill. Senator Siebman?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, actually, if Allison Wolf here from the Minnesota Centers for Environmental Advocacy can specifically address concerns related to the privacy issues.
Sure. Well, and again, if you could describe the bill so we can put the privacy issues in context,
sure.
That helps us out, because I don't think we know what the bill quite does yet. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Ms. Wolf?
Mr. Chairman and members, just as a brief overview, the bill establishes an environmental health tracking and biomonitoring program, and there are various aspects to it. It establishes a pilot program again, though, just to get into some of the more details, Allison Wolf is here to speak to the bill.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Allison Wolf. I'm from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And as Senator Siebman stated, this bill sets up a public health activity at the Minnesota Department of Health. It has two basic components. One is to track environmental health data and correlate disease rates with exposure rates. And the other piece of the bill is to conduct a biomonitoring program, which is a program that will scientifically test individuals for their exposure to hazardous substances to identify the accumulation, if any, of those substances in their tissues and bodily fluids. So these are programs that are being done in a number of other states. Particularly, the health tracking is something that a number of states have undertaken for a number of years. And we would like to see our public health program in Minnesota catch up with some of these activities that we think will help us prevent chronic disease and provide good science to make decisions about public health in Minnesota. I have with me also Samuel Yaman, who is the public health scientist at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and he, as our public health guy, is also able to talk in more detail, if you want that, about the type of data that's being collected and the scientific background necessary to maybe get into the bill a little bit more.
That might be helpful. Mr. Yaman, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. And again, this committee's jurisdiction is mainly interested in the data collection, so please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Samuel Yaman, public health scientist, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Just to reiterate some definitions, environmental health tracking is the collection, integration, and analysis of data on human exposures to environmental pollutants and on diseases caused or aggravated by those chemicals. And this is focused on population trends in disease and exposures to environmental pollutants. Biomonitoring is the assessment of human exposure to environmental pollutants by measuring the concentration of chemicals in body fluids or tissues. Biomonitoring data on its own, on their own, do not indicate whether or not a person has a disease. Within the context of health tracking, biomonitoring data on people's exposure to chemicals are compared to rates of diseases that are known to be caused by those same chemicals. This knowledge can help identify and prioritize which environmental pollutants are a serious risk to public health and which are not. And if the chair and committee would like to hear more about programmatic aspects, I'd be glad to answer questions or speak more on that.
Are there any questions, Mr. Yaman? We have the A3 amendment that's been distributed. Ms. Pine has prepared it for this bill. Maybe she could walk us through it and tell us what it does.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, members, basically this just tightens up some of the data practices language in the bill. There's a couple places where there's references to data sharing, and it just makes it clear that that's consistent with applicable data practices law. The bill isn't intended to authorize the sharing of data that isn't shared right now. And basically just clarifying in one reference where the individuals who are participating in this voluntary pilot program are I think the intent is for it to be on a voluntary basis, but this makes it clear for everyone. And then there's just some data language that's moved to a different section where it really belongs.
Are there any questions on the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll move it.
Senator Higgins moves the A3 amendment. Is there further discussion on the A3 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 1074 as amended?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Did you want to go first?
I have a question.
Okay. After you. Go ahead. Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Yeaman, is this a voluntary test so that I decide not to do it, I don't have to do that?
Mr. Yeaman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. I'm assuming you're referring to the biomonitoring component, and yes, that would be participants that are entirely voluntary and appropriately and fully informed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Sarah Sieben.
And if I could just add a little bit more to that, Senator Foley, for instance, in the communities that I represent, there's been significant exposure to perfluorinated chemicals, and many individuals, since there have been these public meetings that the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency held, more than 500 people showed up, and after those hearings, many people have contacted both the Department of Health and myself to ask how they could indeed have their blood tested to see if they what their rate of exposure to perfluorinated chemicals are. And so one section of this bill would set up a voluntary program where there would be a small number of people, relatively small number of people who the Department of Health would conduct these tests so that people could see what their rates of exposure are. And then that information could be used and compared with different disease aspects that the Department of Health already gathers or will gather under this program. That helps explain it.
Senator Sieben, I guess you answered it by saying that this is a voluntary program and the recipient of this can decide yes or no if you want to participate. That's correct.
That's correct.
Right. Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'm following up on Senator Foley's question. When it comes to, are we talking of informed consent of the individual? Is it an opt-in or is it an opt-out process?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it would be an opt-in.
In all cases?
Correct.
Regarding all of this. Mr. Chair, a lot of this bill really triggers a lot of discussion on data privacy. And if I turn to page 2, in the creation of this biomonitoring health tracking, we're recognizing or commissioning the Department of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease to coordinate data collection, facilitate dissemination of tracking data, develop written data sharing agreements, develop a strategic plan, organize, analyze, interpret available data. This is all on individual citizens. And some of the questions that come up have come up in years before when we've created our Data Practices Act. Take, for example, line 12, page 2, where we talk of health tracking data, facilitate the dissemination of health tracking data to the public and researchers. inaccessible format. We've had a lot of discussion about sharing information with researchers. Unfortunately, when data leaves the state of Minnesota, it's pretty hard to protect data privacy once it goes outside of our borders. We can put a stamp on it that says, please follow Minnesota state law according to the data on this. Now, is this particular data, would it have identifiers on it on the individual citizens?
And Senator Limmer, part of your question may be answered. The Eighth Three Amendment, lines 1 and 2, say that it has to be consistent with applicable data practices laws. But, of course, the point you're making about once it leaves the borders of the state, you know, that's where our laws end. But I don't know if either Senator Sieben or one of the witnesses knows the answer to that. Anybody wish to respond? Mr. Yaman?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the intent or purpose of those sections is for the disease tracking component and the actual information that would go beyond the state agency system would be exclusively on population trends in disease or exposure to chemicals, not, for example, a person A or B has, you know, a certain disease, or person A or B, anything about an individual. So that's purely for population trends and disease.
Mr. Chair, aggregate data, summarized data, non-individual identifier data is what we're talking about.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct.
One other question, Mr. Chair. When I was reviewing the A3 amendment, I turned to the back page on page 6. There is something kind of curious about lines 3 and 4. We recognize the fact that there's informed consent used for this particular program, but the program must follow the informed consent protocol developed by the National Institute of Health. Now, is that any different than the informed consent protocols that perhaps the state of Minnesota has regarding health data of individuals? And what is the protocols of the National Institute of Health?
Can anybody respond to that?
No.
Ms. Wolf?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, we can get that information, and I do apologize because we had not uncovered that. Somebody from the Health Department who knows that, but we'd be happy to supply that. I think that was put in supposedly as comfort language, but not having that information doesn't provide the comfort that we would want to provide. So,
well, Mr. Chair,
tell him, are you comfortable?
Am I what?
Are you comfortable?
I'm not. I don't know yet, Mr. Chair. The question I've raised is quite often we sometimes get bills that want us to follow the protocols of HIPAA regarding data privacy. Mm-hmm. And Minnesota's laws, in many cases, are more protective of individual data rights when it comes to that area. And I am unfamiliar with the National Institute of Health protocols, and I'm not quite sure how far they go. I'm not sure if they are as protective as HIPAA or if they're more protective or less protective than Minnesota state law. So
maybe Ms. Bonias can offer, do you have any thoughts on this?
Mr. Chairman.
It's been a while. Okay.
Senator Limmer, I know I have a file down in my office on this, but my understanding these protocols are primarily targeted at the use of at research practices when people are, research subjects and making sure that they understand what's going on, what kind of information is going to be collected. So it's in that context that those protocols are in place. I don't know if that helps at all.
It
doesn't.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to take that sentence out if that makes Senator Limmer more comfortable, and then we could provide the information and, you know, if need be,
actually,
if he's
he
comfortable
be less
with
comfortable,
it.
I think. I think we should keep it in for the time being because I think that
we'll make a reference on that. If you could share with me that reference.
We'll get you that information.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I have a question on Section 4 on the last page.
Mm-hmm.
The bill would have an effective date of August 1st, 2007, what Senator Betzel just told us on the last bill, the first bill of the day was correct. But on here it says that on or before what would be the effective day, the Commissioner of Health and the PCA and Ag and
and the University of Minnesota have to put a joint thing or together. Are they already working on this so that, this would be an easy target date for them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, they are already working on it. And if you'd like, we could have John Stein from the Department of Health come up and speak to that if you'd like more information.
Is somebody from the department who can speak on that issue? On what's being worked on right now? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Stein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health, Minnesota Department of Health. I think the question was on the extent to which the department is currently working together with other agencies. We do have a working group that we currently utilize. I think the intent of the bill is to formalize that working group and to assure the participation of all the members in an ongoing basis. While we are currently working together, I can't speak to the future interests of all the agencies in working together, so that I would see this as helpful language with regard to the commitment of the agencies to work together.
And
Sir Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stein, that could be done before August 1st?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, I believe it could. I think I haven't personally been involved. I know that I can speak most affirmatively to the state agencies that are involved. I'm not quite sure where the University of Minnesota sits in this conversation at the present time, so that may take us some time and effort to get their participation, but I believe it could be done within that time frame.
And because of that constitutional autonomy thing, we can't even direct you to do it. We have to ask them, so that's the problem we got. Were there questions? Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, if the A2 amendment could please be distributed and I can explain it before asking someone to move
okay.
That?
Okay. There's an A2 amendment. All righty. Oh, I see. Okay.
Mr. Chair, because we're pushing up against deadlines
right.
And this section that talks about the working group that would be established under this, we're not convinced that we need that language in the bill.
You don't want the dreaded scrutiny of GovOps on that part of it. This takes out a working group, so it does not have to go to the GovOps committee.
So moved.
Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment. Is there discussion on that? Is there anybody who wants to be heard on the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? And is there anybody else here who would like to be heard on Senate File 1074 as amended? I believe, Senator Sieben, the next step of this bill would be the Finance Committee because of the appropriation. Is there a motion? Senator Higgins moves that the Senate 1074 as amended be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 714 is a bill commonly referred to as NASPER. It creates a data system for collecting information about the dispensing of Schedule 2 and Schedule 3 drugs. I have a couple of amendments that I would like to have the committee look at. There's an A9 amendment prepared by staff, which is a technical amendment. And then there's an A10 amendment, which takes out the advisory committee. There will still be one, but it won't be specified in statute because of the deadlines. The bill will not have time to go to the Government Operations Committee.
Why don't we take a look at the A9 amendment?
Okay.
Senator Berglund, would you like counsel to go through the A9 amendment?
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, the first part of the amendment just adds a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act to the classification of the bill. And then the next part of the amendment, there's a couple of different provisions in the bill that deal with access by law enforcement. And it looks like I think it just clarifies that in law enforcement always has to be acting pursuant to a valid search warrant to get access, and it puts it all together in one clause rather than having language appearing in two different places. And then, that's the rest of the amendment then. So,
any questions for Senator Berglund or Council on the A9 amendment? Senator Limmer.
Trying to catch up to the section 152.126 that is referred to on line 6 of the amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's the new section in the bill.
Oh.
So in the Data Practices Act, there'll just be a cross-reference. You know, there's always those sections with kind of the index of other statutes that have classifications in them. So.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the new section 152.126 refers to access to data, and is that in reference to Minnesota's statutes on data privacy?
Madam Chair and Senator, this was recommended by staff as a technical amendment.
Okay.
So,
all right,
Madam Chair, Senator, it's in the bill. So, if you look at on page 3, there's a lot of data language that's in the bill, which this is a cross reference to.
Any further questions on the A9 amendment?
I'll move it, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moved the A9 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now on the A10 amendment, Ms. Pontius.
This amendment just takes out statutory language regarding an advisory committee to work with the Board of Pharmacy in setting up the system. There will still be an advisory committee, believe me, but we don't need to have it in statute.
I'll move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Any questions on the A10 amendment? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Berglund, in the advisory committee that we're referring to, does that have citizen members on it or advocates of privacy, or is it more professionally focused?
It was more professionally focused. I think we have all the data privacy protections that we need in the bill itself. But we're taking it out, so it isn't like you can add somebody because I can't get the bill passed if we have this in the – we don't have time to take this to go out.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Berglund, I'm just trying to get a background information. I'm trying to determine who would be on an advisory board that you're referring to that's already in existence. And
there isn't any.
Oh, there is not any.
This would have been newly created to – as the Board of Pharmacy on this particular project.
All right.
Senator Higgins moved the A10 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to spend about 2 minutes on the need for this piece of legislation. I have passed out some handout materials to you. There is money in the federal budget to help states get these systems going. Every year there has been money, and there is money in the president's budget this year. And the reason is because this is a big problem. Prescription drug abuse is becoming a bigger problem than illicit drug abuse. And the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa either have set up a system or are in the process of planning for their systems. And we know that from the studies that have been done by the federal government, anytime neighboring states set up a system, you will see more illicit drug sales of prescription drugs on the streets in your state. So this is a concern about our needing to get system going as well. And then if I can just point out to you, even in the medical assistance program where they suspect an individual might be a drug abuser and they limit them to one physician and one hospital only, we still had 65 deaths in 2005 and 2006 of those clients due to a drug overdose. And so limiting a doctor doesn't solve your problem. What happens is the prescription is provided, the individual goes out on the street and sells their pills, and then they have cash to go buy a prescription outside of the network or system that's been set up to try to restrict them. I also have in the packet for you, in case I don't want anyone here to think that this is just a medical assistance problem, this is an insurance, a sheet from an insurance claim on one patient between the 2006 and the beginning of 2007, and this just goes from August of 2006, and you can see the doctor shopping that's gone on, the different claims of pain for different symptoms and different regions of the body, and the prescriptions that were paid for by this insurance company in regard to a narcotic medication. So we really believe, the federal government really believes, the only way to get a handle on this is to set up this kind of an electronic registry. It will be real-time system, and it will then allow a physician at the time they're writing a prescription to get information about any other prescriptions that have been filled by that patient, regardless of where they were filled, whether they were filled by another physician or if they were filled in an emergency room or where they were filled. I do have some physicians here who have taken time out of their busy schedules to be here, and I'd like to have that testimony at this time. We could call on Dr. Kahn and Dr. Brutger to come to the table first, to be followed by Dr. Sager and Dr. Shephoister.
Members, before we start with the testifiers, just for the record, on the sheet that was provided to us with all the hospitals, I just want the record to reflect that on the bottom half of that page, after the words pharmacy claims, that information will be stricken from the record. And that information will not be reflected in the minutes.
Why? Being the non-lawyer?
Chair, why would that be?
It's the doctor's names.
Those are the names of physicians that are part of this information. And I think that's private information that we shouldn't made public without their consent that they were going to be made public today.
It is, however, Madam Chair, interesting to know that this man got 3 weeks' worth of meds in 7 days' worth of doctor shopping.
I understand that, Senator Higgins, and that's why this bill is before us. But until this bill passes, or even when this bill passes, the reason why this bill is before us is because of the type of information that we've just stricken from the record on data practices. Senator Berglund, I want to first of all thank your testifiers for coming in. I know that they're all very busy individuals, and for them to take the time to come to the committee to give us information is very invaluable, and we appreciate their testimony. That being said, we have a very tight schedule, and the bill that is before us, the pieces that are of interest to us in particular are the pieces with respect to the data practices portion of it. So I will hope that your testifiers would be judicious in the comments that they give to us in respect for the time that we have. Senator Berglund. Senator Foley?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would recommend that if you believe this data is private, that you should pick up the documents and take appropriate action to get rid of them.
Senator Foley?
Yes.
Can you restate that? You would like to take the information?
Send a page around.
Yeah. We'll send a page around to reclaim the document and take it back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Foley, for that reminder. And if any members of the public have taken pieces of that information, we ask you to leave it in the room. Thank you very much. Senator Kahn, Dr. Kahn.
It's Dr. Cohn.
Dr. Cohn.
Madam Chair, thank you for having us here. I'm going to try to keep my comments very short. We know that prescription medication diversion is a very significant problem. The GAO felt it was a severe problem coming back to 2002. The illegal use of prescriptions or the non-medical use of prescriptions in Minnesota runs about 4%, and this is based on data from the U.S. Department of Health. As a pain practitioner, I'm writing pain medications at least a dozen times a day. And the biggest problem is most of these patients have real needs for the medications. It's determining who's using the medications appropriately or not. And the point of having the NASPAR bill is so we can maintain our patient relationship and determine who actually does need these medications a little bit better. It is one of the tools that will allow us to make that decision. We're trying to make sure that this database is private. The only people who will have access to this is the prescribing physician, the pharmacy who is dispensing the medication, and the patient can ask for this information on them on their own. We're hoping that this data basis will allow the physician to identify appropriate patients, identify ones who have seen multiple providers, and prevent a significant problem with diversion. We know that 30 states have passed similar legislation. The rate of diversion has dropped approximately 90% by U.S. Department of Health statistics in the places that have adopted such legal data banks, and we're hoping to get the same legislation approved in this state.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair and Doctor, maybe I'm reading this bill wrong, but you just said that only the prescriber, dispenser, and individual could see this record. But if I'm reading it right, Subdivision 6 also opens it up to the Board of Pharmacy, personnel with the board, a vendor. I'm not sure. Authorized vendor under contract with the board, law enforcement, or personnel of medical assistance.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I was going to get into those details after they're done testifying.
Okay.
I will go over it.
But it is available to people up beyond the
yes.
three that he mentioned.
Yes, okay. Otherwise you couldn't have anybody implementing the system.
Right. Okay. Thanks. So, we'll wait till your explanation then. All right.
Is it Dr. Brugger?
Dr. Bretker.
Bretker. I'm not doing very well today.
That's okay. Madam Chairman and Senators. I was the one who brought in this sheet that you saw, and I got it in the mail just 2 days ago, and I get these frequently. They always come a month or two after I've seen a patient, and I wanted you to just get an idea. This one's not very bad, actually. But if you looked at it, that patient has been to almost every emergency department in the metropolitan area. And I am an emergency physician. I work at North Memorial. And every shift, I see probably at least five or more people that I suspect are trying to scam me. And some of them may be wanting to sell the drugs. Some have uncontrolled pain that they aren't being managed by their doctors right. And some are just addicted. And I don't want to have to be the cop or the detective figuring out who these people are. But I do often spend an amount of time finding out if they're trying to scam me, trying to call their doctor, try to back up their story. And what happens is it makes me suspicious of everybody. So if you had come into the ER last week and said, I slipped on the ice and I landed on my tailbone, like we saw 10 people, and it really hurts, doctor. And I examine them and they don't have a bruise. And I go, is this real or are they scamming me? And what my partners and I do are we want to give the patient the benefit of doubt. We want to treat our legitimate patient's pain adequately. But we kind of get in a bind because we don't want to find out that the patient we just wrote a prescription for 40 Percocet is out on the street selling it. And so we actually undertreat our legitimate patients. If we can't verify their stories, if we don't really know, I'll give you 10 Percocet and you go see your doctor in 2 days, and if you need more, they can give it. Well, 10 Percocet's only a day's worth, and if their back got thrown out or something, they might need a week's worth, and they can't get in to see their doctor in 2 days. You know, if you call, you can't necessarily get in right away. Or some of these patients don't have doctors. Some of them, if they're in the medical assistance one, are lucky if they can get in a couple of weeks. So we really are all frequently under-treating these patients that do need adequate pain control. If I could look in a computer system and find out that Mrs. Smith had not received any narcotics in a month, I would feel so comfortable saying, here you go, here's your prescription, it might take a week, this should last you a week, see your doctor at that point. Without that knowledge, I'm very leery of doing it, and I feel bad because I think I and many of my partners under-treat it. So I think we're not just dealing with trying to catch the bad people, we want to treat our legitimate patients better, and this would allow us to do that.
Thank you. Senator Foley.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Dr. Brucker, how do these people pay for this drug?
Madam Chair and
don't
Senator.
Don't they use a check or something like that?
Madam Chair and Senator, many are covered by their insurance, which is why you get this. And after a few months or 6 months, the insurance agencies will pick it up. Some can pay cash. You can go to Walgreens and pay cash for your Percocet. And then especially if you get some, you can sell it on the street if that's what they're doing. And then they can use some themselves and that. So you don't have to be insured to go to the drugstore.
Senator Berglund, your next witnesses.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to call Dr. Sager and Dr. Shephoister.
Dr. Sager, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My practice is currently focused on spine care, but I've been in the field of pain since 1977 when I was part of the pain clinic at the University of Oklahoma. I helped establish the Pain and Toxicity Research Unit at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, and my career has been devoted to pain management for over 20 years. For the last 6 years, I've worked at the national and state level, first in the state of Washington and with the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians to get NASPR passed nationally and hopefully in each state. This is one of the most important pieces of legislation that has come up in the last several years to facilitate good pain management. And the previous testifiers have indicated that one of the chief problems that we have in managing pain is often the undertreatment of pain because of fear of regulatory oversight and the fear of abuse and diversion. And that interferes with legitimate treatment of pain, has been already explained. This bill gives us the possibility of knowing better, maybe not perfectly, who those diverters are and who they're not, and I think that's the key element here. To the point of what is before this committee, and that is to look at privacy concerns, I think this is something that all of us are concerned about. Nobody wants to establish another big brother that's looking over the shoulder of physicians. And we've discussed this in working groups on the House side of this legislation, and this may need to be refined and looked at, and certainly the gentleman who's going to testify, Mr. Neumeyer, later has given voice to legitimate concerns on the privacy side, and I think we need to pay special attention to making sure that those concerns are taken into account and that those privacy concerns are dealt with appropriately if we need to have amendments in the bill to deal with that. We don't need law enforcement or regulatory oversight committees being able to use this database as a means of doing fishing expeditions. We don't need something that's going to leave physicians feeling as though if they prescribe that they are going to be subjected to some type of regulatory scrutiny, nor do we need patients fearing that if they're private information is in this database that it's going to be some means of it getting out. But there are mechanisms that can be instituted and appropriate modifications if need be made in the legislation to assure that those privacy concerns are taken care of. And I don't think anybody in the pain management community who wants this bill and the family practice docs and the emergency room docs and the people who need this bill and this database to give us the data we need to operate more legitimately have any objections to making sure that those mechanisms for assuring data protection and privacy are put into force in the proper way. And what I would simply ask this committee to do is understand the importance of getting the essence of this legislation enacted and do whatever needs to be done to legitimately protect the privacy rights. And listen carefully to what, for example, Mr. Neumeister has to say, because I think there are some legitimate concerns, but those are correctable. And so I would just thank you for your efforts to polish this up in any way that it may need to be polished up, if that does need to be done, so that we can have what we need without interfering with anybody's privacy. I thank you very much for your efforts.
Thank you, Dr. Senator Foley.
Yes, Madam Chair. Doctor, tell me, heard this anecdotally, where does the DEA get reports of the prescriptions that you give there, and if they do, does that in fact impede or slow up your ability or willingness to dispense drugs of that nature?
Madam Chair, I think under this bill, Senator Foley, the only way that law enforcement would ever have access to this database is if they have a valid search warrant.
Madam Chair.
So no one would have to wait to write a prescription or worry about that.
Senator Foley, can you hang on a second? Let's let the testifiers give their testimony, and then we'll have Senator Berglund quickly explain the bill, and then we'll ask her about the specific issues in the bill. Doctor, is it Schoenpolster?
Schoenpolster. It was close. Madam
Dr.
Chair.
Schoenpolster.
Yes, Ship Oyster.
Ship. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. I'm a family physician. I've practiced in the private practice mostly for the last 25 years in the St. Cloud area, and I'm going to talk from a slightly different perspective, and I'm speaking as a representative of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. We've heard from a couple of physicians who spend most of their time in chronic pain clinics and one physician in emergency room, and I'm going to be speaking from a private office perspective. I've been practicing long enough that there's been a significant change in the in my office and my practice over the last 25 years. I rarely would write narcotic prescriptions 20 years ago. I now see at least three patients every day with whom I have a pain contract with. And what I mean by pain contract is we've actually sat down and both of us have reviewed, agreed upon, and signed a document that states exactly where they can get their prescriptions filled, how they get them refilled. They go to one pharmacy and so on. And they're coming in on a routine basis to get their pain medications filled. The other thing that's happened over those last 25 years is something I think you'll find very relevant to the work you're doing. And that is 20 years ago, when we would become aware of a patient who was probably diverting, inappropriately asking for pain medications, we'd type that up, put it on a piece of paper, and stick it in the mailbox of all the doctors in the doctor's lounge so that everybody knew who that patient was and that didn't become a problem for them. Of course, that has real HIPAA compliance issues and no longer is done. The downside of that, by eliminating that opportunity, we've handcuffed physicians in their appropriately providing pain medications. So just briefly, when I see a patient come in who wants something for pain, there's basically three kinds of patients that might be there. One who's needing something for appropriate pain, that might be a terminal patient, terminal cancer patient with chronic pain problems, or it might be somebody who got legitimately injured 10 years ago and has chronic back pain and requires the narcotic to help them get through their day. The second could be somebody who's chemically dependent and increasingly requiring more pain medications. And then the third is the one that we've kind of talked about, is the drug-diverting patient, the patient who's coming to me. When I was a resident, one of the first patients I saw in my office practice as a resident was somebody who came in with blood in their urine. And sure enough, that was back when I checked my own urines, and there was blood in the urine. It turned out, eventually found out, that he had poked his finger and dipped it in, and he got his narcotic from me and left, and it wasn't later till I learned it. And so it was a good learning experience for me. And what now happens is those rare patients, and I think the number was 4%, and my guess is in my private practice it's even much, much less than that. But what happens is that very small percentage of patients, the perception that this patient might be using me for their drug supplier has a huge impact on my appropriately prescribing pain medications. And in fact, I currently practice with a group of 18 family docs, and half of the docs in my practice refuse to write narcotics for pain for patients. They just deal with the issue by refusing to write it. So it's the perception has had a huge impact, and I would see this database as replacing the old inappropriate stick the note in the doctor's mailbox about how I can now trust that this is an appropriate patient that either has real pain that I need to address, or perhaps it's chemically dependent. That also is a disease that I need to address, and this is one more way for me to get information about it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Schipholster. Senator Berglund, your four docs have well laid the groundwork for why we need this bill. So let's hear what the bill
and
does.
So in terms of the data provisions of the bill limits who can access the data to the prescriber to the extent that the patient is a patient of theirs. So you can't just go in and look at anything in the database. It has to relate to a presenting patient. The dispenser, to the extent that the information relates to a current patient. The individual who is the recipient of a controlled substance can always access the information. Then the Board of Pharmacy would be able to access the information, first of all, to be able to update the system, and secondly, to be able to fax the information to the physicians that are requesting it. It will be a real-time system, but every physician will not just be able to go in on a real-time basis and access the data. The data will be provided through the Board of Pharmacy, and they would fax the information on a specific patient to a physician who is requesting it. And then vendor that they would contract with.
Senator Berglund?
Where's the part in the bill about faxing? My first read through, I didn't see that.
It doesn't talk about it. It just talks about the board providing the information, but that is how they would do it. The Board of Pharmacy. They would maintain the system, and the system would always be real time, so the minute a prescription is filled, they would have that data in their data bank. But the physician would not actually access the system. It would be only the Board of Pharmacy that could access the system in general, and they would be faxing the information then to a physician upon a request from a physician.
Madam Chair and
Senator Neville.
Senator Berglund, shouldn't the bill say that? Or how do we know for sure that's the way it will be set up without saying it in the language of the bill?
Well, the bill authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to design and set up a system. And that's how it's been described to me that it would work. Okay. So at any rate, the Board of Pharmacy would have access to the information then. Their vendor, only to the extent that the vendor needs access to the information to provide technical assistance or to provide support to the system. Law enforcement officials who have a bona fide investigation and have a search warrant. And then the medical assistance program would be able to access it to determine if there are additional people in the medical assistance program on the fee-for-service program that should be restricted to having only one doctor in one hospital because they're suspected of perhaps being a drug abuser. Then the bill, in terms of the data privacy, also goes on then to indicate that the prescriber would never have their name released to another physician unless they had given permission that their name could be used. Some physicians are worried that other physicians will find out what their prescribing practices are, and they might be nervous about that. Others, however, think it would be a good idea if a patient of theirs is seeing another doctor to be able to have a conversation about that patient to exchange whatever information might be important. So, but that would be voluntary on the part of the prescriber to sign a release of information for that. And then we do have all of the data protected by all the state and federal laws. No one else could access the information except as provided in the bill.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, obviously no database and no system is perfect. I'm sure that people are going to find their way to get around it. And as I was listening to Dr. Rutgers talk about working in the emergency room, and I thought, well, in these ideas of identity theft, you know, how does she even know that the person that she's dealing with is the person that she's dealing with? It could be a false identity and so forth. And, you know, there's obviously no way to track it because the accuracy of the information going in the database depends upon the people at the front lines having accurate information. And I'm sure that there's no way to, you know, resolve that because people are going to spend hours trying to figure out a way around this. And, you know, has anyone thought about how we can verify the identity of the people that were getting these prescription drugs?
Senator Berglund?
Well, Madam Chair, it is an issue that the physician would be dealing with in the first place, mm-hmm. because the person's presenting to the physician and nothing goes into this database until a prescription has been written and filled. To the point it is filled, that is then goes into the database. And the law, the bill itself would call for the name and the birth date of the patient so that people that have common names would not be confused with each other.
But, Senator Betzel.
But, and I don't know what kind of identifications are used. Obviously, if you have an insurance card, that may give some information. But when we talk about the people that present themselves at the public hospitals and they may have a driver's license that could be counterfeit and so forth, you know, we could have all kinds of or identify somebody had their purse stolen and then they show up at an emergency room and say, I'm this person and here's my insurance card, and then they access the situation like that. I'm sure there's going to be flaws in the system, but I'm just wondering, you know, if there's thought being given to, you know, how we deal with the wrong person's name, and because the physician couldn't vouch. The physician doesn't know who that person is. I can only rely upon who the person said it was, and if they give me a false name, that's the name that's going to go in the system.
Well, the bill itself,
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, the bill itself allows for us to provide enough detail here so that we can apply for the federal grant to plan how we would set up the system. And I imagine some of these issues would come up in the planning of the system. And I am sure if we pass this bill and we get the grant and they go ahead and plan for the system, there will be some legislation to follow up to, you know, tie down a lot of the details. But we can't even apply for the grant unless we have some basic legislation that authorizes some part of state government to go forward with this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. And maybe this would be one of those details you would look at going forward. I'm certainly in favor of the social policy that this bill is intended to address, but I know that's not the purpose of this committee. From a data practices standpoint, however, I can see where this information would be quickly requested by insurance companies, writing policies, perhaps by employers, by whether it's for following an accident or life insurance, persons applying for Social Security disability. Because the bill allows someone to access their own information, what will happen is that in those circumstances, the individual will be asked through an authorization to request that information. So they're in effect having to provide it in those situations indirectly. And if that isn't your intent, then I would suggest that there should be going forward language that would specifically prohibit those kinds of requests from being made or that kind of burden being put on a person.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Berglin.
Senator Olson, our data privacy laws in regard to medical information always allow a patient to get the information on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you would know why somebody's asking for it. I mean, you could be asked to provide, for some reason, information out of your own physician's medical record on you. You can request to get access to that data, but nobody ever says, why do you want it? I mean, they can't. If you ask for it, they have to give it to you. So I don't know how you could restrict the use of a person's own personal information if they're requesting it, that what they would use it for later or whatever. I don't know how you could enforce anything like that.
Follow-up? Madam Chair, well, actually on the HIPAA authorization, Senator Berglin, oftentimes there is something. In fact, usually when I see the authorizations, they do request or they do have on the authorization where you're supposed to indicate what the purpose is for the information, and that's part of the form. But I guess the point I'm making here is just that that's something for us to consider as a committee, whether we would want to have a person placed in the position of having to provide this type of information, because as long as it's there, unless we say otherwise, I'm sure those requests will be made of people, because it's a streamlined way to take a look at whether they have the amount of their drug use. And so just to be for our consideration to think about whether we want people put in that situation.
Are you raising your hand, Senator Ortman? Senator Ortman.
My pencil, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'm following your thinking. If you think about lawsuits for personal injuries, someone would want to track what happened in a plaintiff's medical care following that accident, mm-hmm. or before the accident even. Prior treatments might be relevant to that lawsuit. But then just like every other medical record, when Senator Berglin talks about it, if you're a party in a lawsuit, you often are asked to consent to the release of all of your medical information. So I'm not sure that that's really going to change that. There's better information now or more pointed information about prescription drugs, but I think that it's occurring in every lawsuit anyway. Plaintiffs and defendants and insurance companies, they all ask that plaintiff to sign the consent to waive and for medical records, and I think they're getting it anyway. My concern is, with paragraph 3, and Senator Berglin, I wanted to ask you, I can see you've given a lot of thought to this, and I appreciate it. My question is, you've got on line 4.1 reference for the recipient of the prescription to be able to access the information. And I can see the purpose of having this. I know a family with a terrible situation right now where everyone in the family believes that the mother is addicted to painkillers. They don't know how to address it. And it's a terrible story watching it happen. And so I'm wondering if there's some way to get at some of those concerns, especially when there's someone who's a legal guardian looking out for that person. So you've got the individual who's a recipient able to receive the records. Couldn't a legal guardian of a minor, a parent, or a legal guardian of someone who is in a nursing home or something like that be given access to the same information if they are responsible for the care of that person? Have you given any thought to that?
Well, usually the way it works is a parent is considered the person to act on behalf of the child to access their records. And the same would be true if you are a medical guardian.
Directive.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I'm not as expert as you are in this field. I'm wondering, is there some other statutory language in some other provision of law that would state that clearly, or is it something we should consider putting into this bill to make sure our intent is very clear?
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglin.
Maybe Senate counsel could help us with this. I'm not sure that we need to add anything, but if someone thinks we do, I'm happy to have it added.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, I think for purposes of data practices law, when the term individual is used, it means a parent of a guardian or a parent of a minor, rather. And I think in guardianship law or any other area of law where the person has a legal status that normally it would be interpreted to include the guardian or someone who could act on behalf of that individual. So that's how I would read it. I suppose you could be more clear about it. But.
And, you know, Senator Ortman, if it's a husband that's concerned about a wife or a child that's concerned about their mother or something, they can always contact the physician and express the concern.
Right.
And the physician could access the data bank. And if they're getting prescriptions on a regular basis from that physician, they automatically would want to access this data bank whenever they wrote a prescription to make sure they're not prescribing in a case where someone would be not using it for a bona fide medical purpose.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to follow up on Senator Ortman's concern, and maybe just for the record, I assume that also covers people who have powers of attorney and health care directives. Would that be included under recipient?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think, because I know the power of attorney, the durable power of attorney for health care statute does give agents authority to get access to medical records unless the directive itself says otherwise. So in that context, I think that assuming that the principal was incompetent, then they could get act. But that normally doesn't kick in until there's incompetency.
So, but a power
Senator
of attorney
Neville.
That had the ability to get records, would this be sufficient? In other words, if you have any legal authority, might be a conservatorship, might be a guardianship, power of attorney, would that be covered under the data practice law, you think?
Ms. Pontius.
Chair, Senator Neville, I don't think that the power of attorney, just the regular power of attorney that you use for property matters and everything, would give it to you. I think the power of attorney for health care would, and then if there was a guardianship of the person, that would give you the legal status. That would be my interpretation of
okay.
it.
Okay. And the health care directive would only apply if the person themselves were incompetent. Is that right?
Ms. Pontius.
No, that's correct.
Okay. Is that enough?
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, if we wanted to follow up with an amendment or some clarification on that, would you be opposed to that? I'd bring it to you, but I just want to make sure it's very clear.
No, I wouldn't be opposed to it.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman, my suggestion is you think about that in the next 5-10 minutes because there are some other questions we're going to have and see if we can address that before it leaves our committee because, you know, we like to keep it in the jurisdiction of our committee if we can. Thank you. Senator Berglund, the reporting requirement, I know that this bill is meant to cover, in the definition, we talk about both the prescriber and the dispenser. Really, the obligation to do the reporting would be the dispensers or the pharmacists, right?
Yes, it would go through the exact same system that's used now by all pharmacies in Minnesota to fill Medicare prescriptions. They all have a real-time electronic system, and that would be what we expect the Board of Pharmacy would plug into so that system for these drugs would report and send that information to their data system.
And then presumably
the reason that the dispenser can also get access to the information is just in case a physician for some reason didn't check before they wrote a prescription, then the pharmacist would have access to it. They could look at it, and they could call the physician and say, did you know that this person has, you know, last week filled the same prescription? And then the physician would let the pharmacist know if they want the prescription to proceed.
Senator Berglund, there's no explicit requirement here, though, that says that the physician and or the dispenser would have to check the database before they either write a prescription or dispense that particular schedule-type medication.
Madam Chair, that's correct. But we do expect that it will be used.
And then, Senator Berglund, when the information is sent to this database, I'm assuming it's being sent electronically to this database, and it becomes part of this cumulative database. How long do you think or is the information held on to?
Madam Chair, I really don't know, but in the information that you have there, you can see that there are quite a few other states that have implemented these kind of systems, so there'll be a standard I'm sure that the Board of Pharmacy and their advisory committee will look at when they make decisions about how to set up the system and how often to purge the information.
So in the absence of that explicit information, this piece of legislation is moving forward, assuming that the information would be kept in perpetuity. Senator Berglund, the bill doesn't provide an opportunity for somebody to ask to be taken out of the database. So the assumption is that anybody and everybody who's a licensed dispenser or a licensed physician in this state would be subject to being in this database.
Yes, it is. It's intentionally designed that way.
And then it is also, the intent is that any individual who receives a prescription for any kind of the scheduled prescription that we have in the bill would also be in the database.
Yes, it is. Both Schedule 2.
And Senator Berglund, I don't see a notice provision. Is there an intent that patients who are going to be in this database should get some kind of notice that if you get this prescription, you'll be entered into a database? Is there an intent to provide a
Chair,
notice?
We had not anticipated that. It would put an additional burden on the pharmacist. Obviously, you can add that to the bill if you want to, but if the bill does pass, everyone who receives a Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 drug would be in the database. And I don't know if there's a way to just kind of put it on the prescription bottles or if there's some way to do it so it doesn't become a burden.
Currently, when an individual gets a prescription and they go to pick up their prescription, don't they already get some kind of HIPAA notice or, you know, a sheet of paper with information on it or directions on it? Do we have anybody here from the Board of Pharmacy or any dispensers here who could maybe give us some practical applications to how this works?
I know that most pharmacists, if they're dispensing those type of drugs, have the person sign a ledger to or sign an electronic part of their system that they actually picked it up and who the person was that picked up the prescription. But
Dr. Sager.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, thank you. The fact is that right now insurance companies and Medicaid have similar databases, and there's no specific notification of those. That all the prescriptions that are handled under most insurance companies go into a similar kind of database. The problem is those databases aren't shared. And this is just taking something that's already in common practice without that kind of notification at all and putting it across the board. But notification could be very simple. Nothing more burdensome than simply having a little sign, you know, at the pharmacy outlet that all Schedule 2 and 3 narcotic prescriptions go into a database. I don't see it as burdensome at all. And notification, you know, any notification would go beyond the notification that's currently done that subjects patients to placement in databases already.
Well, you know, members, I'm a little bit concerned about this issue only to the extent that I think the physician can access information about their patient, the dispenser can access information about their patient, and the patient can access information about the patient along with a whole host of other individuals. But we have put restrictions in here for, you know, accessing information, obviously, for the prescribers and et cetera, and, you know, with the court order and such. And I think that we should give some thought to whether or not I think that we ought to put some kind of a notice provision in here before that leaves. So I'm gonna have staff hand out the A10 amendment for your consideration, Senator Berglund. See if you would like to put that in the bill. I think it would be a good thing in the bill. But I want everyone to take a look at it and see if it's agreeable to the committee and to you, Senator Berglund. Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe this covers it. The point I was going to make was, it's one thing to have your own a person you have a kind of a relationship with keep data, but as soon as the government starts to collect it, don't we have to give the Tennyson warning? And maybe that's what you're passing out now.
Senator Neville, Ms. Pontius did indicate that that does happen in other arenas, and I think that we're hoping to try to address that in the A-10 amendment. Ms. Pontius, does this do it?
Madam Chair, members, I think I didn't have time to really look at the exact warning language and statute, but that was the idea, because technically this data is being collected by a private person, and I don't think the Tennyson warning applies, but it does raise an interesting question, because the private person is collecting on behalf of the government, so it's kind of analogous to it, but I think technically it wouldn't be applicable. So
it's only when the government collects it directly from that person. So you're saying because it's indirect, there's a question that we don't know the answer to it?
Ms. Pontius, can you first explain what a Tennyson warning is, and then we can have the discussion.
Madam Chair, the Tennyson warning, which is named after former Senator Tennyson, is a part of the Data Practices Act that basically is the warning that has to be given to someone whenever data that is not public is collected from them by a government entity, and they have to be told basically what the purpose is for collecting of the data and who is authorized by law to get access to it. It's not required if the government's collecting public data, but it is required whenever the government is collecting something that's not public.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Pontius, and this would be the Board of Pharmacy who's technically collecting this, so that would be a government entity?
Well,
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, that's sort of the dilemma here, I guess, is it's the pharmacist who's collecting it. And so I guess the question is, well, they're collecting
the
it. They're on
is
the front
reporting
line.
It.
And so, I mean, the other thing you could do would be to actually include a cross-reference and say the pharmacist has to comply with the Tennyson warning statute because they're collecting it on behalf of a government entity.
With respect to this particular piece of legislation, not broadly.
Madam Chair, I think the amendment is just fine. Senator Berglund likes the A-10 amendment.
And in light of the Tennyson warning, I hope that this doesn't become the Moore warning, just for the record. Senator Lummer.
I think the Tennyson warning is a good notice for the public to understand why government needs information. If we're requiring a third party to collect information on behalf of the government, then I think the Tennyson warning has to follow because it's a requirement of the government to gain information. We're just asking an agent or a third party, in this case a pharmacist, to collect data. And I think you do have to follow the same established pattern.
And Senator Neville, my thought is that Senator Lummer, my thought is that since the task force is going to, as we move forward, if the board is going to come back with subsequent language to kind of firm up if they get the grant, I think it's sufficient to put in the language that some kind of notice provision or practice ought to be in place. And I'd like, for the record, Senator Berglund, as this move forward, for thought to be given to whether or not we want to, we can easily implement a Tennyson-type warning in the mechanics of how the dispensing, you know, how the information is collected and forwarded to the pharmacy board.
I'll mention that to Mr. Weiberg.
Senator Olson moves the A-10 amendment. Any discussions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-10 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Any further questions? Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to get back to the area where I started before to deal with physician reporting. And I only want you to know that from personal experience, that a person having great pain and the doctor refuses to write a prescription because he's fearful that when the matter goes before the federal level that it be denied access to that. It wasn't me, but it was my wife.
Can you take your phone call outside, please?
In any event, I'd like to know from the docs here that are involved, at least in emergency service or else in some other thing, how do you propose to get around that? Because if I got a prescription even, that you're not going to sell that to me or prescribe it if you're going to lose your license.
Dr. Sager?
Yeah, Madam Chairman and Senator. Fear of DEA scrutiny already exists, and it does interfere with appropriate prescribing of medication. I believe that this type of legislation would help to allay those fears, because what physicians are afraid of is getting labeled as supplying diverters or illegitimate patients with drugs and being scrutinized on that basis. In other words, getting scammed by somebody that the DEA has got under suspicion and maybe brings the doc under suspicion because they cooperate with that person. So I think it gives the physician an additional tool to be more assured that the prescriptions they're writing are not going out to the diverters and the scammers. The provisions that, as I understand it, that are being provided here do not allow the DEA access to this information unless that information is under a search warrant. The only way they can get a search warrant is to have an investigation that already shows that the doctor has a suspect prescribing practice. And the only thing that this database would be able to do is to give the same information that the DEA gets anyway. So this bill isn't a remedy for DEA abuse, and it isn't a remedy for unfounded fear of DEA scrutiny, but it is not a tool that the DEA will have access to go on fishing expeditions. And if anything, I think it should help to reduce those fears of inappropriate oversight.
Members, our citizen advocate, Mr. Rich Neumeister, has some comments he'd like to make on the bill, and then we could hopefully start to wrap up the discussion. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Build it, and they will come. I've seen enough over the years. You build a computer system, and people will come. But what will happen in the future years, let's put this prescription drug, and we'll go on and on. 4 years ago, if we had this, and the Sudafed issue a couple of years ago, more than likely Sudafed would be on here. So what you're doing here, we're setting up practices and standards and something that's going to be happening in the future, and it's going to be in the Board of Pharmacy where other prescriptions will be able to happen. Some of the concerns I have are as follows. On page 3, lines 313, 314, 315, and 316, you are looking for individuals that have that do quantities and that have a frequency inconsistent with certain kinds of standards. Now, who's going to be looking for that type thing? And then I look on the other page, and that is on lines 4, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 4, 6, 4, 7. Personnel of the board engaged in the collection of and doing stuff in their regular duties, and the personnel of the board specifically assigned to conduct a bona fide investigation. My question is, if they see Rich Neumeister, citizen, and they have some things, what are they going to do with that? Who will they share that with? Will that be a suspect list? Will that be an intelligence type thing? Now, the thing is, we're very clear in this proposed law that says that law enforcement agencies, if they have a name and they want to find out about Rich Neumeister, they need a search warrant. But what can the Board of Pharmacy do? Can they release it? And one of the other things that is kind of a double standard here from my personal perspective is that yesterday in Health Committee, there was 322, 323, and 324 was added, which got the doctors and the Board of Medical Practice off the back on this bill, which and they were one of the big holder ups last year and this year until this amendment was adopted. So what happens if when folks are doing their duty under the Board of Pharmacy sees an individual having inconsistent kinds of things that might be a suspect for something? What happens to the doctor when they see that relationship? What can the Board of Pharmacy do with that? Then we go now to the other issue. This is on page 4, lines 414 through 417. Historically, over the years, I always see poor people sometimes being used as guinea pigs by the government. And I have some personal views on that. As someone who came from a low-income background, and my parents were on welfare because my dad was a disabled vet, and I had seen some of this. So we see someone who is receiving medical assistance, some inconsistency, so all of a sudden we're going to take some action with them. But how about if you see individuals, again, going back to 313, 314, 315, 316, what are you going to do with those folks? And that raises issues that, for me, are a little bit of what just equalness in society, equality in society. Now, on the last point, on 431, is a court order. I don't know. There was some discussion previously in regards to lawsuits, things like that. Would a court order in a lawsuit trying to figure out if Rich Neumeister was driving wrong or whatever, was taking Percodin or something, whatever, could a court order issued somehow be used to get access to this? I don't know in what circumstances a court order. Could law enforcement, in an indirect way, get a court order for whatever? Madam Chair, some of the concerns have all been raised, but I've raised some others, and I'd like to thank you very much for the moments of your time. Also, I just want to thank Senator Berglund. She's come a long way since this bill was introduced last year, and it's great with the work that she's done and with the other folks, particularly on the privacy of the search warrants and law enforcement. A major change since last year. Thank you.
Any questions for the witness or any follow-up comments, Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, the board cannot release the information to anyone except those that are already stated in the bill. They couldn't just collect this and give it out to people because they thought somebody should have it. It has to be a request that comes from one of the from a pharmacist, a physician, or the patient, or the medical assistance program for the purpose of determining if someone should be placed on the restrictive medical assistance program. We already have that program to deal with people who might be abusing the program.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last witness did raise a couple of questions, and I was rereading the language on 3.22 to 3.24 regarding that you cannot use the database for disciplinary action, and apparently there was some discussion on this at the previous committee. I'm kind of interested in how that played out, because I think there are instances when the prescribers are at fault. I mean, sometimes prescribers, because they have the ability to make the prescriptions, can overprescribe, and then they, you know, maybe have some arrangements where they can have access to the drugs and so forth. And sometimes there may be warranted disciplinary proceedings, and I'm just wondering if the discussion was that there's other ways to get to them. I'm not quite sure what the background was putting it in, and that may have been another committee's issue, but I'm kind of interested in what the background was here.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I think the Board of Pharmacy was concerned that if physicians believed that they could just access this database, well, that they then might be scrutinized for their prescribing practices, and it might have a chilling effect on their willingness to prescribe prescriptions that they felt were appropriate. So this language was added at the board request. The board can still, I believe, subpoena individual physician records anytime they have an investigation on a physician, and that's how they do it now, and that's how they would continue to do it in the future rather than using this database.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I mean, if within the database you could find some discrepancies from certain providers, if the board felt that they needed that information to, basically go after disciplinary proceedings for a provider, prescriber, they could, through a subpoena power, then use the database information for that purpose? Is that what you indicated?
Senator Berglund.
I said that they could subpoena a physician's records. They could not subpoena this database.
I see. Okay.
Senator Berglund, it's my understanding that the way that the database, the information would come back from the Board of Pharmacy is patient-based. So
right.
It's not, you can't go in there and enter the name of a physician.
No.
It's patient-based, so it would have to be attached to the name of a patient to get a certain set of record.
Right. So it was never a founded fear, but put that language in the bill, they feel that any concern they had was removed.
And Senator Berglund, based on my reading of the bill, it's also my understanding that the information would just collect, that the board wouldn't necessarily go in and do accumulate the information and do a deep analysis. It would just be information that would come in and just accumulate.
It would just be collected, and when a physician or an emergency room would make an inquiry, then they would pull that name up and they would get that information then to that physician.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm going to back to your, what did you call it, patient-based database?
Or patient-based search.
I have never known a database that you couldn't search on almost every field. So if the prescriber's name is in that information, you can search on it, and you should be able to, you could, if nothing else, you could just sort it alphabetically, and all that doctor's prescriptions will come out all in a row. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund,
the bill also says that a prescriber's name may not be released without their consent. So, doing a physician search particular type of database would not be very helpful.
Well,
Senator Neville.
Or a search warrant.
Pardon me?
Or a search warrant.
If you have a search warrant, then you could get the name of the physician, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I'm still struggling. One of the witnesses said, presumably it's the pharmacist who's calling or putting the data in, and presumably would see the database for that patient, and that if he saw something unusual, he'd call the doctor or something. Where is it in the bill that gives one permitted user the right to share information with another permitted user? The only thing I see in the bill that says these permitted users can get access to the database, but it's still private information otherwise. So where does it say that information that a pharmacist took from the database that he could call the doctor up and let them know?
Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund.
And Senator Neville, there isn't any anything referring to that in the bill, but typically a pharmacist in their own practice act has permission to call a physician about any prescription that they're about to fill that they have a question about.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm also
Senator Neville.
I'm also struggling to try to fit subdivision 5 and 6 together because maybe it's covered, but I'm kind of going back and forth. On the one hand, a permissible user can't get it without a search warrant. On the other hand, they're a permissible user, and I'm just confused about when is a search warrant required for anybody except for the doctor, the pharmacist, and the individual?
Senator Berglund.
Is that the
search
intent?
Warrant would be required for any law enforcement individual who wanted to access the database.
Or a licensing agency.
No, licensing agencies could not access the database.
Well, Madam Chair, on
Senator Neville.
On page, line 4.3. Personnel of a board specifically assigned to conduct a bona fide investigation of a licensee is a permitted user. and it doesn't look like they need a search warrant.
Senator Neville,
I believe that was taken out in the previous committee. I don't understand what engrossment you have, but
first engrossment.
This is the first engrossment, Senator Berglund. Take it out again. Senator Ms. Pontius.
I get it. The Board of Pharmacy can access the information, but any licensing board can't.
Board of Pharmacy doesn't license.
Okay.
Board of Pharmacy is operating the system, so they would have to be able to access the information.
So that's the Board of Pharmacy. So a pharmacist or a doctor's licensing board can never get access to this?
That's correct.
That's the intent? Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
Is it time to move the bill yet?
Yes. Senator Higgins? Senator Higgins moves that Senate file
714.
We did adopt the A-10 amendment, right? We did.
Yes.
Senate file 714-1. Oh, Senator Orman, did you get your amendment done?
Yes.
Very good. Let's see. Should we have counsel walk us through that, Senator Orman?
That's fine. It's pretty simple.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, this just clarifies the definition of individual in terms of getting access to address this discussion that came up earlier as far as minors and guardians. And on page 4, line 17, or after line 17, just insert a sentence that would say, for purposes of clause 3, comma, access by an individual includes persons in the definition of an individual under section 13.02. And then that definition, in turn, refers to individual includes a parent or guardian of a minor or a guardian of an incapacitated person. So,
Senator Berglund?
Good amendment.
On that, Senator Ortman moves that amendment as read by council. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 714-1, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? Anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? See none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Senator, is Senator Russ still here? Senator Russ.
Senator Rosen's been here now.
Yes. Sorry, Senator Russ. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here today on behalf of Senator Pappas, who is the chief author of Senate File 1061. She is absent from the Capitol today. Senate File 1061 is a proposal to bring contractors who have a business with the state to begin a system of pay equity compliance. And the first sections of the bill deal with issuing of certificates of compliance, et cetera. And the subdivision that brings the bill to this committee is Subdivision 7, which references the data that will be provided by the contractors in order to meet the standards that the Commissioner of Human Rights would set for gaining a certificate of compliance. It only applies to contracts that are in excess of $500,000. And the data in Subdivision 7 says that for purposes of obtaining it, the data is private on individuals or non-public data with respect to persons other than the Department of Human Rights employees, and then the commissioner's decision to grant or not to grant or any other kind of action on a certificate is public data. And Ms. Watkins is here to answer questions on the data issues that the committee may have.
Thank you. Ms. Watkins, do you have any comments for us?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I will say Bonnie Watkins from the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. Also, it was my privilege to be the state's first pay equity coordinator in the 80s, so I had the opportunity to work with many local governments working on this issue. I would just add to what Senator Rest has said that the intention of the coalition in having this section about data was to really protect the business's right to keep their employee information confidential, that we know it's a very big concern of private sector employers that not be public information, and so that was the intention.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Members, I know that Senator Rest indicated that Subdivision 7 is the only section before us, but actually the Department of Human Rights is within our jurisdiction, and so not necessarily that we want to – I know that this came to us from state and local government operations oversight committee, and they've done some work on the bill. So,
Madam Chair, I wasn't aware of that additional jurisdiction. Sorry.
And so it's not our intention to undo the whole bill. We ought to pay attention to the data practices subdivision, Subdivision 7. But certainly if you have any other questions in other areas, feel free to ask Senator Rest or Ms. Watkins. I think I want to ask if there's anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill. And I know that the department had expressed some concerns, but I don't know if they've, had that discussion. Ms. Hansen. Senator Neville.
I have to like to ask the witness, and I apologize that I should know this, but are pay equity laws right now, is the private sector subject to that, or is that just public sector?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, not in a direct sort of way. Minnesota has two wonderful pay equity laws that apply to state government and every unit of local government. But Human Rights can probably respond better than me. There is not a systemic approach to the private sector with respect to pay equity right now. A person can still file a human rights charge on that basis. But
if they were discriminated against on gender grounds, for example.
Exactly.
But there's right now in the private sector, there isn't any pay equity law. But this bill would say it would, in effect, it would apply if you're going to be bidding on state contracts?
In excess of $500,000.
Okay.
Senator Rest, I understand that I know you haven't seen the A1 amendment, but it's a technical amendment addressing a cross-reference, and I'll have Ms. Pontius talk about that.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, this is just, again, the same issue we had in other bills. It's a cross-reference in Chapter 13 to the data practices classification that's in the bill.
Are you okay with that, Senator Rest?
On behalf of Senator Pappas, yes.
Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair, members, first of all, I want to say that the Department of Human Rights is supportive of this measure. We do have some concerns about the implementation and execution of the bill language. Is it the committee's wish that I limit my comments to Subdivision 7, or can I speak fully?
Yeah. Speak fully.
Madam Chair, members, again, to be perfectly clear that the department is very supportive of the concept of this bill. We want to make it work. We just have some we see some areas as being problematic. We have not seen a full fiscal note. We haven't seen any fiscal note. We do believe that this bill would have a substantial fiscal impact on the department. this pay equity compensation plan would be on an equal track to the department's current affirmative action plan for state vendors. It would require the hiring. First of all, the department doesn't have an expertise in this area, so we would have to acquire that. We would have to hire more employees. We'd have to update our database or create a database system for this function. In the state and local government, they did raise the dollar amount from $100,000 to $500,000. Our concern at that time was that this language would be a barrier to small businesses, specifically female-owned, minority-owned, and veteran-owned businesses, especially in the area of construction contracts. Many of these construction companies are what we refer to as mom-and-pop organizations. They have little or no human resources. So for them to get up to speed on this component and be competitive in the bidding for state construction contracts is a concern for us. We want to make sure that we're not disadvantaging anyone in that process. The second subdivision requires either a plan or a good faith effort. We, again, without some further advice, we do have a concern being referenced to Minnesota Statute 471. That relates to public employment or public employers. Certified contractors are almost always private employers, so there's a distinction there. If there's a requirement, and that rulemaking that's attached to that particular state statute is under the jurisdiction of Dewar, which is about to be sunset. If there's a requirement that the department engage in rulemaking, we want to make sure that it's understood that we are not funded to do so, and that would extend out the implementation timeline if that was required. Subdivision 3 is a filing fee. It is consistent with the filing fee required for affirmative action plans. We just want to make clear that the filing fee will in no way fund the initiative. What we have found in the adding to the act, the $75 fee for affirmative action plans, is the department actually lost money. We run in the red on that issue rather than benefiting for the department. So we don't see that as a financial benefit. Technical assistance. Just briefly, from March 2006 to March 2007, we have 9,000 recorded contacts for technical assistance for the affirmative action plans alone. We anticipate with this new provision that that number would double, perhaps triple, in the first 2 to 4 years as companies get up to speed on what this requirement means to them and what they have to provide to the department in order to be a state contractor. And again, there's a fiscal cost to that as well. Subdivision 7, which is the data practices provision, this senator and Ms. Watkins explained about the classification. What I'd like to explain to the committee is this. Currently, under the affirmative action plan function of the Act, payroll data that is provided to the department as part of that function is now considered to be public data. That same or similar data that would be provided under the pay equity compensation plan function is listed here as private or non-public. So it's our understanding that the same data could have two data practices classifications, which, of course, poses a problem to the department in addressing requests for information. What we see now under the affirmative action plans is companies being extremely reluctant to provide us with any payroll data at all. And in fact, quite often the department will go out on site to the company to review their payroll data if needed, rather than to have them send it into the department and have it considered to be public. So I just want to give you that alert that there is a hesitation out there by companies in providing their payroll data. And again, my last comment here briefly is the effective date. The department, again, is supportive of this language. We would like to see it implemented. We'd like to see it work. And the implementation date of July 1st of this year quite simply, is too short for us to get up to speed and to educate the public and the companies that would be applicable to this. Mm-hmm. We hope to work with the Pay Equity Coalition in future meetings and hopefully iron out some of these issues. Be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Hansen, there are some of the ironing out could be later, but in terms of the effective date, we can't let you iron that out later, so we have to address that tonight. Do you, Senator Rest, do you have any suggestions?
Madam Chair, I think that the Department of Employee Relations could be extremely helpful to the Department of Human Rights. And even if the Doer merger bill goes forward, the functions that Doer is doing are not lost. We in the State Department's Budget Division had to make some leaps about what kind of savings we could claim beyond that of the commissioner herself. I'm not unsympathetic to maybe pushing out a pushing out an effective date, but I certainly wouldn't want it to be beyond the end of the year.
Ms. Hansen, do you have any thoughts on what would be a doable effective date?
Madam Chair, members, I don't have a date in mind. Again, we want to make sure that if the department assumes this function, that we do so in a manner that we can fully implement it. Right now, fiscally, I just don't see how we can do that. If there's a mechanism in place that would allow us to fully fund this, then and get up to speed, we would certainly make every attempt to do so by the end of the year.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
I appreciate the fiscal considerations, but we don't have a fiscal note on it. I'm assuming that the Department of Human Rights is working on a fiscal worksheet at this point. And if the committee acts favorably on the bill and sends it to finance, it is there that the adequacy of the filing fee, for example, will be taken into account, and what other kinds of fiscal impacts there would be to see whether or not this indeed is something that we want to go forward with. I'm not aware that Senator Pappas had received a fiscal note or even a fiscal worksheet from the Department of Finance.
Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems to me, if I understand the testimony, I mean, most of the questions raised by the department are fiscal, and obviously those are going to have to be dealt with in the Finance Committee and probably the Public Safety Budget Division. But the fiscal note will probably be generated based upon the current effective date. And if I heard the testimony correctly, even if they had a lot of resources dedicated for it, it's even questionable whether they could meet this particular date. So I'm just wondering if it wouldn't make sense to just extend the effective date outward, and that's going to still have to be adjusted at some point within the Finance Committee based upon whatever resources are available, what the costs are. But it sounds like just sending it there with this effective date is just going to generate a fiscal note that says we can't do it under any circumstances. So I would suggest, Madam Chair, maybe we could make the effective date January 1, 2008, which does push it out a few more months. It might, whether the resources are there is another entirely different question. But at least that gives the department some breathing room so that when they prepare the fiscal note, they can say, if you fund it, this is what we can do. And even that may not be reasonable, but as I understood the testimony, July 1st, 2011 is not workable under almost any scenario. So
Senator just wondering. Rest.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Watkins to comment on, in her working with Senator Pappas, on why July 1, 2007 was chosen, certainly to get the system going. It would require one-time money in the current fiscal year because the system is proposed here to be in place for the next fiscal year, and there would be ongoing costs, but there certainly would be a need for one-time money out of the current surplus that's available in one-time money before July 1 of 2007. But if I could ask Ms. Watkins to comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your blessing, the experience, again, that we had back in the early days of pay equity in the Department of Employee Relations, I think, is really instructive that, first of all, that law was implemented in a very phased-in manner. The Pay Equity Coalition does have a meeting scheduled with the Department of Human Rights tomorrow morning, and my apologies, we weren't able to do that, schedule that sooner. But I really believe we will be able to work out some of these details, so you all don't have to think about it. But in partial summary, the phasing in, I think, how the good faith effort is defined can really make this far simpler for both the department and the employers. We would like to keep the effective date soon because, for example, in the first round of solicitations that the Department of Administration sends out, we would really like for companies responding to that solicitation to be able to at least state their intention to undertake a pay equity plan so that, you know, I believe from the Pay Equity Coalition, some of those very early signals of intent would really meet that good faith standard. And we would, quite frankly, feel like the show was getting on the road, which, again, historically was so much more important to start moving in the right direction. Furthermore, it truly was amazing how much one person in Doer could do with 1,600 local units of government. Employee Relations does to this day have wonderful free software available on their website that the Department of Human Rights could look at right now, that any employer could use right now. So there's a lot of work that's been done, and I realize the private sector is different from the public sector in some very important ways, which is partly why we tried to make this data part work. We can talk more about that tomorrow. But I truly think the process of analyzing your workforce has become so much easier than it would have been 20 years ago. So we would like to try this July effective date, but with the understanding, of course, that nobody is going to have achieved pay equity and be able to document that by July 2nd.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Because I sit on the Finance Committee, I'll have another shot at this one, whereas others will not. I'll just observe, Ms. Watkins, I was listening to the testimony, and I'm trying to help keep your bill alive and keep it moving.
I appreciate that.
Now, you don't have a lot of bargaining power here, because if you get hit with a killer fiscal note, this bill dies. Even if the legislature passes it, and the governor and the commissioner works with the governor, and she tells the governor veto it, the bill dies. So I think you may want it effective July 1st of 2007, but everything I've heard says it cannot be done. So I'm not going to offer the amendment here, but boy, by the time it gets to Finance Committee, I'm not voting for this thing in this one unless these issues are resolved. So I won't offer the amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you very much. I really appreciate your observation.
I'm warning you.
Thank you.
Senator.
And Madam Chair, I'm very sensitive to Senator Betzel's comments, obviously, and I will convey them to Senator Pappas, who also sits on the Finance Committee, that she needs to do something about this bill.
Senator Rust, on line 1.21 and 1.22, I think that we should delete Chief Executive Officer of the and just allow that to read if the business. I think a direct reference to Chief Executive Officer of the, I mean, there are companies who might not necessarily have one, if that is amenable to you.
Yep.
Senator Olson moves that on page 1, line 1.21 and 1.22, delete Chief Executive Officer of the. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Members, I'm wondering if, in terms of the data classification issues that Ms. Hansett has raised, I am somewhat concerned about that, and I think it would involve that we might have to amend another section of the law. How difficult is that going to be, Ms. Pondias?
Madam Chair, members, I think, in fact, the section is actually attached to your summary. It's 363.8.36, which is the current contract compliance language for affirmative action plans. And I think what would work if the committee was willing to just adopt this in concept, would be to take the same language that appears in the bill on Subdivision 7 dealing with access to data and make that parallel language would be a new Subdivision 6 in 363A.36. So that would classify that data as well as private and non-public, except for there would be the public data would be the decision to grant or not grant or suspend or revoke a certificate would be public. And then you have to make the same correction in the cross-reference.
Ms. Hansen, any thoughts?
Consistent.
Madam Chair, members, we wouldn't object to that. It seems to address the issue. We just want to make sure that we're not having two classifications for the same data.
Any thoughts on that suggestion, members? I think that Ms. Hansen raised a good question about inconsistency and if we could help address that. Senator Olson moves the amendment on the inconsistency of the data classification as described by council. Council will be given some latitude to make the inconsistency, to cure the issue of the inconsistent classification. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Higgins moves that Senate file 1061 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Rosen, you've been sitting in the audience for a while. Who else is here? Senator Bach? Senator Bach. Senator Bach, you've got three bills. Depending on how long Senator Rosen takes, we like to take a break by 6 at the latest. So we'll see where, if members could kind of help us stretch it a little bit. It means less work from when we come back from our break, if we can kind of just stretch it a little bit. I think Senator Rosen's bill is going to go fairly quickly. So hang in there, right? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And it is true, it is probably my one and only chance to be in front of this committee, so I'll make it good and expedite this. Senate File 1072 basically creates a study on prenatal drug exposure. This has already gone through health policy. And it's specifically a study on methamphetamine, cocaine, morphine, morphine derivatives, and THC. And the reason why this bill is before you, of course, the data issues that come with a study, but I just want to just tee it up just a little bit before I hand it over to Dr. Payne here. The National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare, which is a program of SAMHSA, estimates there's 10 to 11% of all newborns that are prenatally exposed to alcohol or illicit drugs. So that's estimated to be about 400 to 480,000 exposed births nationwide. And there was a 10-state study, including Minnesota, that they came up with these figures. So you ask the question, how are we doing with identifying substance-exposed infants? And basically, most are not identified, and most are going home, 75 to 90%. Of the substance exposed infants are undetected and go home. And we've done a tremendous amount of work on studies. The first one was fetal alcohol syndrome. The second, a very strong one, was cigarette smoking. We did studies on crack. But we don't have any specific studies dealing with methamphetamine or you can go on. But methamphetamine is really what brought this study to our attention. With that, I am going to turn it over to Dr. Robert Payne. He's the medical director for the NICU at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and he can explain this much more in detail. Thank you.
Thank Dr. you. Payne, welcome to the committee, and have any of your patients ever told you that?
My patients don't tell me anything. I only take care of newborn babies. So we have a lot of nonverbal communication, but no verbal communication.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My practice is restricted to newborn babies, sick newborn babies, and I've had an interest in what happens to babies who are exposed to drugs prenatally and how does that influence their outcome, both in the short and long term. My concern about prenatal drug exposure is that it has many consequences for the baby. They are often small. They're born more likely to be born at preterm. They may have anomalies or birth defects. In particular, they are at high risk when they go home, living in an environment which might be somewhat chaotic. I don't have a good understanding, at least, of the extent of this problem. On the basis of other studies that have been reported, the incidence is anywhere from 1 to 5% in high-risk areas, but it's quite geographically variable. So it's difficult for us to extrapolate how big a problem we have in Minnesota on the basis of studies that are done in Honolulu. I believe it's underreported, but I have some concerns that in order to make sure we are responding appropriately, that we need a better understanding of, in fact, how much of a problem is it for our communities. There were a number of missteps that were taken with the cocaine abuse and the concerns about the exposure to the babies that occurred in the 1990s. And in order to avoid that, we would like to have more basic information to understand what is the extent of the issue. That's the purpose of the study. The concerns that I would think would come up with any study such as this would be the issues of data privacy and people having to give specimens and so forth. And there are several layers of protection that would be provided for individuals as a part of this study. First, the data would be collected anonymously. We don't need to know who people are. We don't need to know their name or other identifying information in order to get the overall incidence information that we need. Second, we would propose applying and obtaining a National Institute of Drug Abuse confidentiality certificate, which supersedes state and federal law and prevents us from having to report any information that we gain as a part of this study to law enforcement agencies. We would also be able to question mothers about their prenatal drug use or lack thereof or extent thereof without them giving us information which could possibly be incriminating. And finally, this would be done by consent. So if a person does not want to consent to this, even though it is anonymous and even though they would receive an immunity from the information of the consequences of the information given to us, they could opt out.
Dr. Payne, on that last point, you said that it would be done by consent, but I don't see in the bill a reference to consent. And I understand that the samples would be taken randomly, but I'm looking at page 2, Senator Rosen. Also, I'm looking at page 2, starting at line 1. You are collecting maternal demographics and some pretty specific information. So I don't see a reference to consent in the bill. And I think, just as with Senator Berglund's bill earlier, when I expressed that concern, I also have that concern that this piece of legislation, we should be a little bit more explicit. So, Senator Rosen?
Yes.
I've asked Council to draft the A1 amendment for your consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any reaction
Madam
to that?
Madam Chair?
Senator Foley.
Before you get through with the amendment you have, I heard the witness talk about the National Institute of Health regulations being with supremacy problems. There's nothing that I found in the bill that deals with that. Can we include something? I guess it's already in the.
I believe Senator Foley was referring to the certificate from the National Institute of Drug. Dr. Payne, could you refresh our memory on that? The certificate from the National Institute of
Drug Abuse.
Can you talk a little bit more about that certificate?
That certificate, what it is it allows us to obtain information from a mother, and then.
prevents us from having to then report that information. If she says, yes, I use methamphetamine throughout the pregnancy, if as a physician, if I were just caring for her and I had evidence that that was true, I would then be forced to report that to Child Protection Services. The purpose of the certificate of confidentiality is to keep that information confidential and not to be forced to report that.
Dr. Payne, would you be opposed to having that information made explicit in this piece of legislation?
Since that's our intention, there's clearly no objection.
Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, that would be fine. And the A1 amendment looks fine, too.
Senate Council will contemplate that and will give us some language, Senator Foley, that would work on that point. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, my question refers to the last line of your amendment, the A1 amendment. It's very similar to the same question we had, discussion we had before. We're referring to a consent protocol developed by the National Institute of Health, and I'm not sure if anyone knows what that is.
Senator Limmer, Senate Council will explain the protocol of the National Institute of Health.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the best I can tell is I have a file downstairs on it where I just printed out a bunch of information on what it is, but I can't give you the details off the top of my head.
That was the answer she gave me last night.
Senator Limmer, the interest in doing this, and there certainly are other ways to do it, and so this is not the only way. I'm offering this as a point for discussion. But when I looked at the bill, I was concerned about human subject and human subject consent. And I believe that the National Institute of Health and their protocol addresses that. And I think Dr. Payne and Senator Rosen agrees and recognizes that. Dr. Payne?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the assumption was that in order to do this study, it has to be approved by the Institutional Review Board of each hospital in which the specimen is collected or the person is interviewed. And each of those institutional review boards would require that those sorts of protections which have been established at a federal level be met at that individual hospital level. This does not supersede the requirement. This legislation does not supersede the requirement to obtain IRB approval at each institution.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Maybe counsel could help us here. If that's the definition that we're thinking of relying on, is that a HIPAA-referenced consent protocol?
Dr.
Payne?
Madam Chair, Senators, could you repeat the question? I'm not sure I understand the question. There was noise.
Madam Chair, you said that it made reference to some federal ruling code, something to that effect.
Yes.
Is that a HIPAA-referenced requirement?
No, sir. It's not related to HIPAA.
Okay. However, how does HIPAA intersect with this? Because HIPAA guides the direction of data privacy from a federal perspective. Minnesota sometimes has stricter rules on data privacy, and consent is a key element to data privacy when it comes to the release of data, and sometimes in this case it may even have reference to specimens. So where do we intersect all of this and make sure we don't violate state law?
Ms. Padias?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, there isn't any particular state law that deals with the research protocols and getting informed consent for research purposes. So I think you need to separate sort of the research purpose concept from the data concept, which, like HIPAA, deals with access to medical records, and then obviously Minnesota has a statute that in many ways is more protective than HIPAA. But my understanding is that the federal standards with respect to research apply, and in Minnesota really doesn't have anything in place. But regardless, those federal standards, as Dr. Payne indicated, will apply, and they will have to comply with those in terms of the internal review boards and how they implement a research program within a hospital.
Madam Chair and Council,
Senator Limmer,
if we cross a line where we identify an individual identifier in the data, then does the data privacy protections of state law kick in this case? As long as it's aggregate data or summary data, then it's okay?
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes, I mean the bill is intended to have just the the aggregate data. There would be some ability to, you know, track data with respect to individual samples. That's why if you look here, for example, any data that are submitted are classified as private or non-public, although I think the anticipation is that they would not be collecting actual patient names or anything. There might be like codes or some identifiers to track the individual data with the sample, but you would not actually have a name.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Payne, I live in a district where, anecdotally at least, I know that there's a perception that there's a large problem as far as the number of mothers giving birth to babies who are have been exposed to methamphetamine. And I'm just, and I've often thought, because of data privacy issues, that this is really a tough problem to track and that it would be very useful to have some information that you could base real remedies on rather than just anecdotal information. But I wonder how valuable the information is going to be if the mother has a right to decline participation, because it seems to me that the people who would be the most likely to be abusing methamphetamine are the very people who are not going to want to consent to take part in your study. And so what value is there going to be to the information? And I'm concerned we might rely on that information and we might address or not address the issue as not being a problem, as though this were accurate information when people don't have to participate.
Dr. Payne.
Thank you. To answer the question about HIPAA, if I may just go back to that, we do not propose collecting any information protected by HIPAA. We won't collect the birth date. We won't collect the name, the mother's name. The birth weight will be in categories, not in a specific birth weight. So we propose excluding HIPAA-protected information from this study. We're only interested in aggregate epidemiological estimates. So that's that answer. The question that you asked is a good question, and I think that's why that the confidentiality certificate is so important, is that women are reluctant to give information which incriminates them as having been engaged in criminal activity or that would put at jeopardy their ability to take their baby home. In other words, child protection would intervene and possibly take their baby away. And so I don't think this study can be done without consent. I don't think we can just obtain the specimens. That isn't right, I don't believe. And similarly, we have to be able to protect those who participate. I'm hopeful, and in other studies, one of the interesting things has been that if you give the people this certificate of confidentiality, that many women are willing to come forward and say, yes, I did abuse drugs.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Dr. Payne, I understand the dilemma. And I understand the need for this information and the desire to want to encourage women to disclose. But I'm also concerned about the welfare of the babies. And I know there are situations where babies need to be taken away from their mothers in these situations, at least temporarily. Are we going to confuse the issue for these mothers or perhaps, you know, I mean, in a situation where they are going to be asked this information by child welfare or by law enforcement, are they going to be asked by different people for one purpose and given a different set of instructions and then asked for by other people? Or I don't want to put a chilling effect, I guess, on the ability of law enforcement and child welfare people to do their job.
Senator Olson, are you referring to the potential for the patients to be confused because they've been led to believe that nothing will happen to them when they give this information, but perhaps they're just protected under this research project? However, if a doctor who is a mandatory reporter should report that and they get into trouble for that they might get confused?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about the issue of confusion, and I'm also concerned about that if there is a situation where appropriately a child needs protection, that we wouldn't somehow not be following up on that in the way that we normally would simply because this mother is a part of this study.
Dr. Payne.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The study would not preclude a physician who had reason to suspect use from doing what they always do, which is to obtain the specimens. For a baby, if I have medical reason to think that this baby has been exposed, I don't need the mother's permission in order to obtain the specimen from the baby, because this is part of the baby's medical care. And I'm then under a mandate to report that to the Minnesota Department of Health and also report it to Child Protection Services. So this study would not get in the way or get in between the usual care which is provided by physicians and other care providers and the patient. The idea is that the person who goes and does this private interview would not be a person who is providing care. It would be somebody specific to the study who identifies themselves as such and who makes clear their relationship to the patient, which is that they have no caregiving relationship. And the certificate of confidentiality does not give people immunity from such things as neglect or abuse or something that happens subsequent to the interview. It's just for that research study that they receive immunity from acknowledging that they use prenatal drugs prenatally.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, on this same point, I guess I'd like to clarify how these laws interact as well. You're saying that there's something in federal law that supersedes the state mandatory reporting law we have? Even if it's not the care provider, they would have a mandatory duty to report too, but for this confidentiality certificate, wouldn't they?
May I respond? The confidentiality certificate does not influence one way or another a provider's mandatory requirement for mandatory reporting. I mean, if the provider identifies a patient as likely having used drugs, or they volunteer that information, they're under the same obligation that they would be, because the providers will not be part of this study. The confidentiality certificate is only for the study. It doesn't include any other part of the hospitalization.
Senator Neville.
Maybe I'm the only one who's just not tracking, but you say you got the doctor who's providing the care.
Yes.
And their duty won't be affected if they have some knowledge that the child has been affected. And you got an independent person who's going to do the study.
Yes.
But that person has a duty to report too, doesn't he?
That person does if they didn't have the certificate of confidentiality.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, my question is then, I just want to make it clear, there's some federal law then that says that it supersedes our data reporting law?
No,
Dr.
it doesn't.
Payne.
Thank you. What it says is that the information doesn't have to be reported. Yes, that's my understanding of the certificate of confidentiality, if it's done as part of a study.
Okay. So that federal law has to supersede our mandatory reporting law somehow.
For the sake of the study, yes. It doesn't change anybody else's relationship to the patient or to the state law.
Dr. Payne, as the who would be the one that would be the point of contact with the patient for purposes of the study?
Study nurse.
A study nurse that will be designated by the hospital that's participating in the study?
The study is identified to be done by the Minnesota Department of Health so that it has the broad reach throughout the state. And they would organize the study and identify study research nurses who would go in cooperation with the hospital and interview the mothers to collect that information.
Madam Chair, this is 3,000 samples at least at three different hospitals, one outside the greater metro area. And it has to be in areas where there are significant birthing hospitals to acquire this information. And I will say it would be a lot easier if we could just take a sample of all the babies that are born, but we can't do that because of the data privacy issues. So this, we've been working on this for several years, and this is the route that we've taken with Senate Counsel and Dr. Payne and the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Minnesota to somehow get our hands around this issue, because this issue is coming our way. We see it over in the West Coast, and it's advancing this way as far as babies, ramifications of illicit drug abuse by the mothers, and we need to know what we're up against, especially now that we have a drug-endangered children protocols set in place in the state, and we're working on that with different counties. We have our state methamphetamine coordinator, Mr. Chuck Nuremberg. You didn't know I just advanced you. and so this is a significant part of the agenda to protect our children, along with the Drug Endangered Children initiative also.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, can you keep track of the number of refusals you receive without any identifying information being attached to that number?
Yes.
Dr. Payne?
Thank you. Yes, you can. And there are statistical ways to go in and try to wait for that to get some estimate as to how much that has skewed the results.
Members, I think Senate Council has some language proposal.
Oh, Madam Chair and members, at least for now, this addresses that certificate of confidentiality issue. And I think the easiest way to do it would be working off of the A1 amendment. And on line 4, just before the period insert. And let's see. I was going to say, and must include certificates of confidentiality issued by the National Institutes of Health.
Ms. Pondius, I think it might need to be a separate sentence.
Yeah, I think so. Madam Chair, members, perhaps what you might want to do is have a separate sentence that just says that specimens may be collected only if certificates of confidentiality issued by the National Institutes of Health have been obtained.
Senator Rosen, do you have some place to go tonight?
I do, actually, Madam Chair. I have some constituents at the downtowner.
Well, we're going to be here.
From drug courts. Madam Chair, do you need to work on this language a little farther?
Do you have any co-authors that are in the room?
Do you have any co-authors on the committee, Senator Rosen?
Marty Berg and Lori.
No, Senator Berglund, Senator Lori, and Senator Marty.
You didn't think the bill would be coming here, didn't you?
Well, I'm glad, Madam Chair, I'm glad the bill is here because you'll tighten it up to the way it needs to be tightened. So I appreciate that.
Ms. Pondius.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I think for now if you just put another sentence on looking at the A1 amendment after the period on line 4, insert specimens may be collected only if certificates of confidentiality issued by the National Institutes of Health have been obtained.
Senator Lemmer.
Chair, counsel, obtained by whom?
Madam Chair, members, I assume that would defer to Dr. Payne. I think that that'd be by the hospital.
The certificate of confidentiality would be obtained by those who organized the study, which would be the Minnesota Department of Health.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer, follow up.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the issuance of certificates, is this a certificate that's common to this type of practice?
It is commonly obtained for this kind of research where you're asking people to give them possibly self-incriminating information to the researcher.
Senator Lemmer, I think I would be more comfortable if that language were to say that the research project can only go forward after this research certificate has been obtained by the Minnesota Department of Health.
Madam Chair, on the original 1.4 line, where it says developed by the National Institute of Health, we're not doing any damage to that particular line as of now. And should we put a reference to that protocol as of a date? Or I know that Council and I had talked, and there was actually the reason why there is a protocol is that it's subject to a Public Health Service Act, a federal law that it actually refers to. And would we rather want to refer to this federal site rather than a protocol developed by the National Institute of Health, which may be subject to change in the future? Maybe you'd want to pinpoint the time that we're referring to now, because 10 years from now, they may have a different informed consent protocol. And if it's not specified in our state statutes, we may just open the book and see whatever's there sometime at that point in the future.
May I respond?
Dr. Payne?
The certificate of confidentiality is specific to a study.
It is not something that you receive as a blanket. And it has to, you have to, first of all, have your study approved by the Institutional Review Board, and then it has to be submitted, and it's quite a lengthy process, to the National Institute of Drug Abuse in order to get that certificate. And once you get it, it's only good for the life of the study, which we propose to be 1 year, 12 months from the time we start. So we're hoping that this will not be an ongoing matter.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think on the amendment, you have the wrong institute. I think it's the National Institute of Drug Abuse that the certificate
Senator Higgins, there are two national institutes.
Yes, the consent protocols come from the Institutes of Health. And
correct.
The certificate comes from the Institute of Drug Abuse.
Which is a...
If I remember correctly.
The NIH is the umbrella for them all, as I understand it. Within the NIH, there are several institutes, blood and cardiovascular diseases, and so forth, infectious diseases and so forth.
Okay. All righty.
A1 is a member.
Somebody moving A1?
I think, though, that I want to get back that the language should be the certificate of confidentiality before the project can commence.
The project, by definition, can't commence until we have the certificate of confidentiality, because otherwise you can't interview the mothers and get the consent from them.
So the A1 amendment will contain that sentence to reference that the confidentiality agreement, that the study project will not start until the Department of Health has obtained the certificate of confidentiality from the National Institute of Health.
May I just make one comment? The project needs to have some ramp-up time in order to get organized, and so the project would start, but could we change that perhaps to no specimens would be collected or no individual would be approached until the confidentiality certificate was in place?
That's fine. So the language will revert back to what Council has stated earlier then in terms of the reference to the specimen. On the A1 amendment, Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment with the language that's on the A1 amendment and the language suggested by Council with broad latitude to make sure that it encompasses this discussion.
That's an amendment.
Very good amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Senator Betzel.
Okay. Madam Chair, I do have two quick things. We're going to be asking for some rather sensitive information in this survey. And on page 2, line 1, we have to get marital demographics, including age, marital status, county of residence. Is marital status really germane, important to what we're doing here?
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I do think it is, actually, because we are trying to narrow, with the limited information that we are collecting, we do need to narrow down, perhaps, a little more categories. And Dr. Payne, if you'd like to.
Well,
Dr. Payne.
Thank you. I think that information is important. And there has seemed in all the studies that have been done so far that there is there are some real differences in the marital status, and one of the reasons why that's important is in terms of the kinds of approaches that we might take to intervene and to help those families.
Senator Betzel.
I've got a second issue on line 27. The commission will show issue a report of findings of the study by September 15, 2008, and that's going to be submitted to to the House and Senate committees have jurisdiction. Well, in the Senate, I mean, nobody's going to be here for 4 months. In the House, they're going to be involved in an election cycle, and they won't even know who's going to be chairing whatever committees or who's going to be on the committees for another 4 months. So what purpose does it serve to send a report to the legislature in September 08 that nobody's going to look at it for 4 months? Shouldn't you want a little bit more time to get the study done right and get it over to the legislature when people are actually going to be here to see it?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, that would be fine. I believe the thought was to send out a report, but perhaps we'd have more effect from the study to be able to introduce it to both the House and Senate in committee.
Senator
Madam Chair, my suggestion, January 1509 would be at the start of the next biennial session. That's probably enough time to get a report in after the holidays and get people, to start looking at it. So I'd move on line 27 to change September 15, 2008 to January 15, 2009.
Any further discussions? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen and Doctor, thank you for the bill. My question is,
Senator Ortman,
on that amendment?
Sorry. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, Senator Ortman.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen and Doctor. My question is, if you have 3,000 participants and say there are going to be 10 or hopefully not 10% that actually have some kind of affirmative contact with drugs during the prenatal period, what we're essentially agreeing to right here is for those 10% to create an immunity to any kind of intervention and the confidentiality for what occurred during their pregnancy and any implications to their children. I just want to make sure we understand. Is that what you're saying? You want us to create that immunity and confidentiality for whatever percentage might be? But it's a random group, so we're talking to 3,000 mothers. Am I following?
The
Dr. Payne.
Thank you. The immunity is only for the information that's released to the study. As I said, any other information which these patients who would be identified through other means other than the study would not have immunity. In other words, if the baby comes out with obvious symptoms that might be related to drug abuse and the physician caring for the baby orders a drug test, that information is reported the same as it would be without the study.
And Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, also we are trying to narrow down specific drug abuse issues. And sometimes when the drug is used in the early part of the pregnancy, it doesn't show up until later on after the baby's in school and it has ADD issues and on and on. So we are trying to figure out exactly when does it show up in the meconium and what kind of issues we're going to have with this child long-term down the road. So there is it didn't really get into that because we were just looking on the data privacy, but Dr. Payne could maybe explain that a little more clearly than I did. But
well, I think that what we are trying to do is to, first of all, find out what is the extent of the problem. And everybody has an opinion, but not much data or information. And part of our concern is that we don't want to overreact, but by the same token, we do want to react appropriately. And that's why I think it's important for us to get a sense of what's going on, not just at one hospital or in one practice, but rather throughout the state of Minnesota, trying to design a study which would randomly sample and give us the ability to extrapolate that information to the communities throughout the state.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I make a grammatical? On
Teacher Higgins.
Page 1, line 15, delete the word less and insert the word fewer.
Fewer.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Foley moves that Senate File 1072, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Anybody else in the audience want to testify on this? Seeing none. Any further discussions from the members? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your members, appreciate it.
Welcome back.
Senator Bach wants to go eat dinner. So Senator Bach wants us to not eat dinner so he can go eat dinner. Make it very fast.
Madam Chair, we could all go at the same time.
I move the bill.
We move the bill.
Which one?
Madam Chair, where would you like to start? Yeah. Two of the bills are revenue bills.
Let's start with those.
Is there any money?
These are just PS. 24?
Madam Chair, let's start with Senate File 1024, the Department of Revenue's collection bill. And the department is here to walk through the provisions that are of interest to this committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Rick Walzer. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Revenue. The collection bill consists of six sections. The first four sections deal with Chapter 16D, which requires the Department of Revenue to collect non-tax government debts that are referred to the department. Section 1 amends a provision in Chapter 16D regarding the scope of services provided by the department for collection of non-tax government debts to clarify that those services apply to all referring agencies, not just state agencies. Section 2 amends the provision regarding the manner in which debts are referred to provide that agencies do not have to wait for the mandatory 120-day period of delinquency to run before referring the debt, as long as the debt is uncontested and all appeal rights regarding the debt are gone. Section 2 also provides that agencies must refer debts electronically and removes obsolete references to the Commissioner of Finance, because throughout this chapter, the word commissioner means Commissioner of Revenue. Section 3 eliminates the two-tier system for applying the percentage rate for collection costs charged by the Department of Revenue, which is currently 15% and 25%. This system is replaced with a new flat rate of 17%. Section 4 amends the provision for annually adjusting that rate in Section 3 to eliminate the Commissioner of Finance from jointly determining the rate adjustment with the Commissioner of Revenue. Thus, the Commissioner of Revenue will be solely responsible. Also, Section 4 is amended to conform to changes made in Section 3 so that language in Section 4 referring to the two-tier rate system for collection costs is eliminated. And Sections 5 and 6 are tax collection amendments, which has nothing to do with collecting non-tax debts. Section 5 amends the personal liability provision for assessing responsible parties in a business which has failed to pay certain types of business taxes, such as sales and withholding taxes, to clarify that this kind of liability includes the applicable late payment penalties for those tax types, as well as the amount of unpaid tax. This change is necessary because of a recodification that took place a few years ago. And finally, Section 6 amends the state tax lien law to authorize liens filed with the Secretary of State to be transcribed to a county. This provision is needed because of a law change in 2002 requiring that for a tax lien to be properly perfected against any kind of personal property, the lien is filed with the Secretary of State. Transcribing becomes necessary when the department discovers that the same taxpayer owns real estate in a particular county, and therefore the lien has to be transcribed to the county where the real estate is located. And that concludes my explanation of this bill.
So, how do you transcribe something?
Madam Chair, transcribing means that you take a certified copy of the lien that's been filed, for example, with the Secretary of State, and you file that certified copy in the county where you wish to transcribe that lien to. So it's not a new lien, it's an existing lien.
And then, Ms. Walzer, when I'm referring now to Section 2, when the agencies give the information back and forth, what types of information gets referred? When the agencies refer the debts back and forth, what information is contained in that referral?
Madam Chair, The information that's given to the Department of Revenue is the name, address, any other identifying information of the debtor, the type of debt that is owed, and who the debt is owed to, when the debt first arose.
Any other questions for Senator Bach, members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just as a, in the past, sometimes we've rolled this into the data practices bill that came out of this committee. Sometimes we just send it on to the tax committee and it's been carried there. I don't know if there's any been discussions with the other body, you know, where to put the language. Senator Bach, do you want it in the tax committee for your bill?
Madam Chair, if this committee would like to carry it in their bill, it doesn't matter to me, but if
Senator,
I don't have a preference.
Senator Bach and Senator Betzel, the reason we took it up in the larger committee instead of in the data practices subcommittee was because we wanted to just deal with these small provisions, send it back to the tax committee so they can put it in their omnibus bill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, then, if there's nobody in opposition to it or it must be heard, I'll move it, Senate file. 1024 be recommended pass and be referred to the committee on taxes.
Is there anybody here in the audience who would like to testify in opposition to this bill? See none. Senator, on Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, Senate File 611 is another department bill. It's the department's disclosure bill. Again, a small amount of information in, but the department can walk through it.
And members, the sections that are before us are only sections 1 through 4, so Senator Bach, if your witness can stick to just those sections, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 1 amends Minnesota Statutes Chapter 270B, which is the Department of Revenue Tax Disclosure and Data Practices Chapter, by adding a reference to the motor vehicle sales tax, and this is due to the fact that the Department of Revenue occasionally handles these kinds of cases. Section 2 is a technical clarification which strikes an existing clause in the law and replaces that clause with a separate sentence to clarify that the tax informant provision does not apply to property tax. Section 3 adds a provision to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 270B to clarify that the Department of Revenue can use tax return information to collect non-tax debts. And finally, Section 4 has to do with the job zone and biotech zone programs. These programs involve three different government entities: the local unit of government where the business is located, the Department of Economic Development, and the Department of Revenue, because of the tax reductions that are involved for that business. And Section 4 authorizes the Department of Revenue to share tax information with these other entities so that these programs can be administered. That concludes sections 1 through 4.
Senator Bach, Council has drafted the A1 amendment, which is a technical amendment to address a cross-reference to the data practices subdivision. Have you taken a look at
Pretty
that?
Pretty mundane to me, Madam Chair.
Is the department okay with that?
Madam Chair, the department supports the amendment.
I believe this is why you came here. Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment. Any questions, any further discussion from the members? See none. All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, if there's no one else to be heard on Senate File 611, I'd move it. Senate File 611, as amended, be recommended to pass, may be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Anybody in the audience who wished to speak on this bill, either for or against? Seeing none. On Senator Betzel's motion, any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1378, and there is an amendment I believe the committee has that was put on in the Tax Committee, but because the bill was laid on the table in taxes, the bill wasn't engrossed, and I believe the committee has that. But, Madam Chair, what the bill does is, under current law, when the Department of Revenue receives seized cigarettes, they have three options under current law. They can sell them at public auction. They can give them to the Commissioner of Human Services for use by patients in state institutions, or they may destroy them. And what this bill does is removes two of the options that the department has to give them to patients in institutions, and it removes the provision that they can sell them at public auction and leaves in its place the opportunity for them to be destroyed, or it adds two other ways they can be used. They can be used in enforcing a criminal provision in state or federal law, some kind of a sting type operation, or can be used in an ongoing criminal investigation. And that's what the bill does.
Any questions for Senator Bach? These are the provisions that brought the bill to the committee. Senator Betzel moves.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Do we have to put the A1 amendment on the bill if it's in the engrossed version, Senator Betzel?
Oh, do we do not have...
We didn't get the engrossment in time. I believe the A1 amendment was already on the bill.
As I understand it, the A1 amendment is on the bill in the Tax Committee, but because it was laid on the table for possible inclusion in the tax bill, Council doesn't draft an engrossed version.
I see.
How do we get the bill then, Madam Chair? If the bill was laid on the table in the Tax Committee, I don't know how it's before us. Was it sent from the Tax Committee to the Judiciary Committee?
Senator Bach, I thought that the bill was sent here from the
Tax Committee. Well, I believe it was sent here, but for some reason I was told Council doesn't engross the bill. And I don't know the reason.
We'll just adopt the A1 amendment.
I think that's
all right.
That's
we'll send it back to you fully integrated.
And Council might be able to tell me why we don't have an engrossed version, but that's what I was told.
Any questions? Do you all have the A1 amendment? Any questions, Senator Bach, on the A1 amendment?
No.
All right. Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, just a curiosity question. How many cigarettes do you expect will be destroying? How many are forfeited in a typical year?
Ms. Walzer.
Madam Chair, Senator, We seize truckloads of cigarettes, so I don't work in that area, but my understanding is that we have enough to fill up a storeroom in our building.
So this happens frequently then.
Beg your pardon?
This happens quite a bit.
That's correct.
Okay.
Senator Neville, did you ever see the Beverly Hills Cop movie series? In one of those, the opening scene was, Eddie Murphy and cigarette contraband. My era. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1378, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The committee will recess, and we will come back at 7:15.
We are going to dinner at the same time.